Okay.
We don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to start the meeting so that we can get done. We have a lot of people to testify today. And this is a meeting of both the Policy Committee and the Finance Committee. We're meeting jointly. Representative Thiessen has some bills up in other committees, so he may be in and out. And I just want to give a little introduction to, we've had 2 weeks discussing the government's budget pages. And today we're going to hear about some other budget pages that are outside the government and the situation that various healthcare providers find themselves in today. And to start off, we have Lynn Blewett from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, who is sort of a health economics kind of person and used to be in the Department of Health when I first got here. So, Dr. Blewett, why don't you go ahead with your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. Today I'm going to do an overview of what we know about the economic impact on the healthcare delivery system in Minnesota. I'll talk first about unemployment and changes in unemployment, changes in the nature of private health insurance coverage, hospitals as the first line of defense, and I see you have a list of hospital representatives, so I'll probably kind of go over that fairly quickly, a little bit on the rural impact, state and federal action, and then some more recent data. I just want to say that I am an associate professor at the School of Public Health, and I work at I have a research center called the State Health Access State Assistance Center. It's largely funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who's provided some support for this presentation. And I'm also a faculty representative to the board of the Fairview University Medical Center, just so you're aware of that. And I want to acknowledge my colleague, Ira Moscovitz, who's the division director at the Division of Health Policy and Management, and Annie Mock, who's one of our students in the School of Public Health. Okay, so of course I've got a few caveats. Most of the data that you can find, especially for providers in Minnesota, which are traditionally mostly non-for-profit, are based on annual aggregate data. So most of the data that I have is 2007 data. And as you'll see that some of the revenue implications in 2007 were looking fairly rosy. And most of the downturn in the economy started in 2008. And really the last quarter, maybe the last quarter of 2008, is really where you're starting to see the impact, and I'm sure you'll hear from the hospitals who are going to report on kind of that last part of 2008. Now, because the hospitals, the providers, only report on an annual basis, we really won't have that data till this time next year. So you really have to rely, I think, on the hospitals and the provider groups in terms of getting information. Now, what you hear in the press is typically, you know, for-profit providers who have to report quarterly to their stockholders. And so that's the things that you hear in the newspapers and in the national news. So there's clear indications of a downturn in the economy in 2007. And I should say that some of the positive revenue that I'm going to present is really serving as a buffer for what's happening now. So first of all, unemployment is clearly going to increase the number of uninsured. Unemployment in Minnesota continues to increase. It was 4.5% in January 2008, and just in December, 12 months later, 6.9%. So there's no sign of abatement there. In 2008, there were a total of 55,400 jobs lost, and this is the largest rate of unemployment in the state of Minnesota since 1984. The healthcare as an employment sector is clearly one of the largest in the state of Minnesota. It currently has over 20% of the non-farm employment are employed in the economics in the healthcare sector. And I should note, when you look at the unemployment numbers, education and health services actually added 11,000 jobs. And so if we're going to look at these numbers next year, and you'll hear from the provider associations that they're starting to cut jobs. So again, the rosy period of 2007 has helped to buffer the impacts that we're going to start seeing in 2008. And there's recent evidence of job loss in the healthcare industry, as I'm sure you've heard in the local press. This is just a visual of the monthly rate of employment from 2003, where it was below 5%, and increasing almost to 7%, and this is in November 2008. We tried to do some estimates of, you know, well, how many of those who are newly unemployed would be uninsured, and this is a model that was, we found a couple models. This one was done by the Urban Institute, which looked at national data and showed that a 1% increase in the national unemployment rate would increase Medicaid and CHIP enrollment by 1 million people, and an increase in the uninsured by 1.1, an increase in state spending and federal spending at $3.4 billion. So this is across the whole nation. So we tried to do some estimates on what we have a 2.6% percentage point increase in the last year from in our uninsurance rate. And it's in the presentation where we estimate an increase in the number of uninsured of about 12,000 people and an increase in Medicaid CHIP enrollment of 13,000. And again, if we have severe cuts to the Minnesota Care and the Medicaid programs, it could be as many as 25,000 newly uninsured in just 1 year. The second thing that's happened in addition to the increase in unemployment is the changing nature of employer-sponsored coverage. So Minnesota has enjoyed a long tradition of high coverage rates, and that is not due to our generous public programs, which of course we have, but it's really been primarily due to our strong employer market. So employers have traditionally provided health insurance coverage, and we've had, you know, traditionally had larger coverage rates in the employment sector. But similarly to what's going on in the nation, Minnesota's also starting to see a drop in employer-sponsored coverage. We're also seeing an increase in shifting the cost increases on to consumers in terms of increase in co-payments and deductibles, and then also more out-of-pocket spending for individuals and families. This is the drop in employer-based coverage from 1999 to 2007. So you can see 72% of people had health insurance through their employers in 1999, and that has dropped to 59% in 2007. What this means is that if you don't get coverage from your employer, you have to go out and find it, either in the individual market. This also creates pressures for our high-risk pool, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, and some people will not get covered, so that increases to the number of uninsured, and then also increased pressures on Minnesota Care and our other public programs. Increase in high deductible plans. So we see higher out-of-pocket spending both for individuals and family health insurance plans. This results in a delay of either seeking care or foregoing care altogether, and I think the hospitals will tell you they're seeing a decrease in their patient volume. People are delaying elective surgeries. They don't want to pay that $5,000 deductible. They're just going to wait. They maybe can't afford the $5,000 deductibles. So this results in more uncompensated care if you can't meet that deductible and still need to get treatment. This leads to lost patient revenue and more bad debt for hospitals. This is enrollment figures for January 2008 in terms of enrollment in health savings account high deductible health plans. So these are the high deductible health plans that have a health savings account attached. Minnesota has the six highest enrollments of 325,000 people enrolled in those plans, and has the highest percent of people under age 65. So 9.2% of our under age 65 population is enrolled in a high deductible plan with a health savings account. These high deductible plans, so you can either have an individual policy or you can have a family policy. The average deductible for the individual policy is about $2,000. The average annual deductible for a family policy is $4,000. So again, your plan, your coverage does not kick in until you reach that attachment point where your insurance would kick in. They do have some limits on your out-of-pocket spending. For individuals, it's $3,100. For family policies, it's about $6,000. And the premiums you can see there are $3,000 for an individual policy, $8,000 for a high deductible plan. That tends to be the average for a family plan is about $12,000 if you were to purchase a fully insured product. So they are a little bit cheaper, but they do have those large deductibles. As I said, we're starting to see increases in both fully insured plans, in addition to the high deductible plans, of policies that have more policies that have a deductible. And I want to thank the Health Economics Program, Julie Sonier, and who provided some of this data, which is very fresh off the print. And I'm sure you'll see some of this in other formats. But for example, this first one shows. So this is the Minnesota small group market. So there's small employers who are providing health insurance coverage, which shows an increase in the percent of enrollees with any deductible. So only 34% had a deductible in 2002, and that's increased to over two-thirds of all policies have a deductible. This shows sort of how much. The next chart, the distribution of deductibles in the small group market. So in 2002, if you look at the brown bar on the left-hand side, 81% of people had a deductible of less than $1,000. And you can see that by 2008, which is the gold bars, that has increased to 29% from 1,000 to 2,000, and about a third of those plans have a deductible more than $2,000. So this is really a changing type of health plan, which is moving away from first dollar coverage and more to plans that have significant out-of-pocket costs for consumers. This is a small group market that has the high deductible plan with the savings account. So these are your traditional HSA plans that you may have heard about. Again, just a significant enrollment in those types of plans of over a quarter of the population in the small group market having a health saving account type of plan. And even in the individual market, when you go to purchase, again, they are also selling and more take up of the high deductible health plans with the saving account option. And then this again, it reiterates for those in the individual market, more than two-thirds, 67%, have a deductible of more than $2,000. And very few have deductibles of less than $1,000. So just to reiterate this point is the changing nature of the private health insurance market, which is again moving towards more deductibles, more higher out-of-pocket costs for consumers. One of the things that we've been looking at my research center is this concept of underinsurance, and or you could think about it as adequate coverage, like how much coverage is adequate to cover your healthcare needs. And there are a lot of different ways of looking at it, but one of the, one of the more traditional ways that you see it in the research field is high out-of-pocket expenditures, including co-insurance, co-payments, and deductibles that exceed 10% of net income. So if you're paying more out-of-pocket than what your income can afford, that would be considered inadequate coverage. So when you get to deductibles of $5,000 for someone who has a very low income, they could maybe not be really covered for an adequate health insurance plan. We did some estimates of out-of-pocket spending greater than 10% for household incomes. This is just for privately insured now, and this is for children. And I present the national estimates, which are actually going down for kids. And then in Minnesota, a slight increase in the number of kids and families whose out-of-pocket costs exceed 10% of income. And I just put some comparison states so you can see it's not very different in terms of if you look at the scale, but what you should think about is why is that going up. This shows the estimate of out-of-pocket spending greater than 10% for privately insured adults. And again,
if I could interrupt, sure. Representative Hodge has a question. I just have a question on this graph. The numbers, do they represent a million or?
It's a percent of the total population.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yes.
For Minnesota, it's 3.8%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, yes, that's right.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see I don't have my percent there on my scale. So for adults, it's a little bit more, and we're consistent with the national trend, and it's consistent with the data which I just showed you, which is an increase in deductibles and paying out of pocket for healthcare spending, with almost 7% of Minnesotans under age 64 paying more than 10% of their income for privately insured adults. This graph is just to illustrate when we traditionally think about, on the left hand side, we think about health insurance coverage. We think about either you have coverage or you don't have coverage. So the yellow is our uninsured rate. The brown is coverage, and that's typically how we think. And you might break that up into publicly insured or privately insured, or employer-based insured and individual. But really, you're insured or uninsured. And I think one of the things that we're starting to see an interest across the state is this concept of, well, what is an adequate health insurance coverage? And if you think about, if you adopt the notion that greater than 10% of your income is maybe too much to pay for health care, that would be considered uninsured. We have some people who are in limited benefit plans that might be considered underinsured. And we also see people who are getting these primary care limited benefit products. Many of you are familiar with Cortico, where you may just get a primary care benefit and pay a fee per month. We're starting to see those around the country, and many of those people think they have health insurance coverage. So if you take the privately insured and think about those other components, that could be potential inadequate coverage. So one of the things that I want to emphasize is this changing nature of private insurance, along with sort of this, you know, crisis in the employment sector. So it's just something to think about in terms when you think about, well, what is that private coverage? What does it look like?
Representative Walker has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Lewitt. You've given us a good measure or tool to look at in terms of out-of-pocket costs and what might be determined inadequate. Is there a similar measure for premium levels? Because at the same time that cost sharing has been shifted onto the enrollee, premiums are still going up. And so is there a similar sort of measure that your monthly premiums shouldn't exceed X percent of your net income?
Dr. Brooks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we can look at that, and that sometimes that is included, but typically that's a predictable cost. And so you can calculate that either in or out, and we certainly could do that. That's a good point. I mean, it's certainly a part of healthcare expenditures.
Continue.
Okay, so the impact on hospitals, and I stress, especially since we have a whole hearing room full of hospitals, that this is an early impact, and this data is for 2007. And first of all, I want to stress that hospitals provide the most free care to the uninsured. So as we have increase in levels of uninsurance, the hospitals are typically one of the first levels of care for the uninsured. And this chart just illustrates the distribution of health insurance coverage and the percent of uncompensated care costs by provider type. And hospitals provide 63%, this estimate of 63% of all free care to the uninsured.
Commissioner, is that a hospital cost? Is that the cost to the hospital, and does that include any physician charges that were involved with the services delivered in the hospital?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the physicians are pulled out of that into the physician clinic component, but I would have to double check. So the general impact on hospitals, you've heard and we've seen a decrease in patient revenue, more patients delaying or foregoing elective surgeries due to the high copayments and deductibles, increase in uncompensated care, more uninsured working age adults needing care but cannot pay. Hospitals are key to providing care for the uninsured. We're seeing an increase in bad debt. Increase in the cost of borrowing money, access to capital, loss in their investment portfolio, and then a loss in philanthropy, which they rely on in terms of in this state where they're mostly for-profit hospitals. This shows the Minnesota Hospital Uncompensated Care from 2002 to 2007, and probably what's most important.
If I could just interrupt. Did you say, I think you missed, said what you intended, but I thought you said that we're mostly for profit, and I think there's only one hospital in the state that's for profit.
Mr. Chair, yes, I misspoke.
Okay.
We are mostly non for profit. We rely on philanthropy donations. This is Bubbles of Minnesota on compensated care, which is broke down into charity care and bad debt, and this is from the health department. And I think the most important part is to see the blue share between 2006 and 2007, which shows a significant increase in the bad debt component of that uncompensated care. So that's care that's paid for and you can't collect because people can't pay it. In terms of the charity care, that's for people who the hospitals assess are low income and qualify for free care. So the bad debt component of the charity care is increasing, and probably the 2008 numbers, which you may see later today, will show that as well.
Representative Abler has a question or comment.
Just a question. On the uncompensated care, is that based upon charges, average reimbursable rate, or cost?
Representative Chair, Representative Abler, this has a cost to charge ratio included, so it would be based on that discounted rate, the average discounted rate per hospital. So it's not charges.
Thank you. And Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I run a business too, and when you have bad debt, where does it go? What do you do to compensate that? Where does that bad debt go?
Representative Huntley, Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, that bad debt is traditionally included in the cost of running a hospital, and so that's part of their book of business, and they charge other payers and make up that cost through other revenue sources.
What are Mr. Chair,
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, payers, so Blue Cross Blue Shield, insurance companies, they in turn pay it and pass it on to in the form of higher premiums.
Go ahead, Dr. Blewett.
As you all know, there are certain hospitals that provide more uncompensated care than other hospitals, and this just shows Hennepin County, which we've seen an average across all hospitals about 2%. Hennepin County provides about 9%, so I think it's fair to say that with unemployment and pressures on the healthcare system, Hennepin County is going to be hit particularly hard. And so this is just to remind you that there is variation across the hospitals. When we say 2%, there's some hospitals, and particularly Hennepin County, that provide more uncompensated care. Now, this chart I kind of was reluctant to put up, but and the hospitals can maybe comment on this, which is these are the operating margins and profit margins, which have been pretty healthy in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. And I think in terms of what's happened in the last year, these numbers are going to be drastically different. But it also, I think, is maybe a positive message, which is they have some margin with which to withstand this next year. I don't know how long they can withstand these next couple years, but they have had relatively healthy profits from 5 to 7% in 2006 and 2007. And you'll see, again, we don't have aggregate numbers for 2008, but you'll see some of those numbers with the hospital presentation. This is the percent of U.S. hospitals. So this is a national...
I could interrupt again, Representative Abler.
Thanks. So could you just clarify what operating versus profit margin is? I don't know the difference. Like, what the chart means is that... Can you explain the chart? I mean...
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, so operating margin is what their operating costs are. The profit margin is what is net above what they need to keep their operations going.
Maybe somebody else can help.
Could you go through that again? I'm confused on that one too.
My understanding is operating margin is the cost of doing business. So basically, that's what they need to run their business, to pay their bills, to run over into the next year, and so that's their operating margin. The net profit is what is in excess of that. So they use in this state with non-for-profit hospitals, then that net margin is used to, in a non-for-profit world, to feed back into the system or to build on capital and reinvest in their programs.
I just take another run at it. So is the light blue line that's above the green line, or whatever color it is, the profit? If I subtract the two, is that the profit they made, 2% or whatever it would be, from 7.4 minus 5.6 or something like that? Is that right, or am I totally off?
No, the profit margin is 7.4% for 2007.
All right. Well, I'll phone a friend later.
Jim and I will sit in a dark closet.
That sounds fun. Will help me figure this out.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Abler, it may comfort you to know that I don't entirely understand this either. I understand the profit margin part, but my comment was just going to be that it would be interesting to break this out by at least by types of hospitals, because this is aggregate data for all hospitals.
That's right.
And I wonder if there's a difference. Maybe you can just tell me, is there a big difference in, say, in that profit margin for rural versus urban hospitals, or you know, is there another way to break it out that is this aggregate hiding vast differences between groups of hospitals?
Dr. Bloch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I mean, this is an aggregate amount, so there would be a lot of variation, and clearly rural small hospitals have smaller profit margins. There's a lot of variation. We could certainly present that for you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question about, not that particular slide, but the one just before, the largest providers of hospital uncompensated care. I don't see Regions or Ramsey County in there, and I'm just...
They should be in there. Some of these names are... Annie, do you have the Regions one? Yeah, they are in here. I'm just not clear which of these bars that aren't. The names didn't show up. We'll fill those names in for you and get that up to you. I'm not sure why they didn't show up here. Regions is definitely on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No.
So this is a rapid response survey that the National American Hospital Association did and asked their members, what are you doing to respond to the economic crisis? And this first question was, what are the various effects of the credit crisis? So they were specifically talking about the credit markets. And first was most of them have increased interest expense for their variable rate bonds, increased collateral requirements, difficulty in refinancing auction rate debt, inability to issue bonds, inability to roll over credit, acceleration of debt, and inability to withdraw funds held by financial institutions. And this is what I've heard from the hospitals I've talked to has been kind of the most problem, is not getting access to those credit markets. They also asked, what are you thinking about making or considering changes in response to the economic crisis? And 60% said we're going to cut administrative costs, we're reducing staff, 53% reducing services, other divesting assets, considering a merger. And so I'm sure you'll hear from the providers today of similar kind of strategies to meet these economic challenges. So for rural health care, it's just to summarize that the recession will likely hit harder in smaller rural communities. There are more small employers, more pressures on costs, more uninsured. The hospitals do have operating on a smaller revenue base. They'll have a bigger impact when patient revenue declines. They don't have a lot to absorb those changes. And certain areas of the state, primarily the Northeast, are facing higher rates of unemployment and uninsurance. And the safety net is quite fragile, and oftentimes the hospital is the only safety net provider in a lot of rural areas. We're here in the metro, we have some community clinics and free clinic services available. So just some quick comments on some of the...
Mm-hmm. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, is it also true that in rural areas the hospitals are also the hub for a lot of the clinics? In other words, a lot of the clinics and other providers are also tied directly to the hospital, so the hospital's health is even more critical in rural areas because of that. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, they're a critical component of the kind of the network of the healthcare system there.
And Representative Godwell, most of the rural hospitals have like 60% in public programs, which underpays the cost. So whereas most of the metro hospitals have maybe 40%.
Dr. Blewett.
So we tried to estimate the impact on Minnesota uninsurance rates. Again, this is kind of preliminary and back of the envelope, but if we estimate there are 84,000, 19 different numbers, we just picked one number of uninsured from proposed cuts to the budget. There'd be more uninsured cuts from the Minnesota Care Program. And then we looked and we used the urban model to estimate the number of uninsured due to unemployment through 2008. And if you assume those unemployment rates continue through 2009, we estimate a potential increase of uninsured by possibly 483,000 uninsured, which could raise the uninsured rate to about 9.3%. And again, this is just to think about if the unemployment rate continues and if all the cuts go through and the estimates are right, and if you just add up the numbers, this is a potential increase in the number of uninsured, which again will impact the rest of the healthcare system. These are the trends in Minnesota uninsurance rates, which between 2004 and 2007, there was a slight decrease. And, you know, what's going to happen in the future, we'll have to wait and see. But it looks like, you know, there's definitely going to be more uninsured due to unemployment. And depending on how the budget goes through this session, there may be more. The federal stimulus package, which, you know, changes daily, but this is kind of the latest information that I had, was there may be a 4.9 percentage point increase in the federal portion of the FMAP for Medicaid. So Minnesota, we're at the lowest FMAP, as you know, at 50%. So, you know, we're at the floor. That would increase to 54.9, and if my calculations, it's about $225 million, which on a budget deficit of $4.8 billion. At one point, it seemed like that would be a good, you know, a bigger amount of money, but it doesn't seem like very much. There's an additional FMAP increase based on the state's unemployment rate compared to a base period, and we clearly have had a large increase in unemployment. So we may qualify for an additional bump to that, but I don't know. They've said 19, I think the base was 2006, and so it's not clear what the base was and how much the additional funds would be. And then also the federal subsidy of COBRA to help people who lose their jobs to buy COBRA coverage. And in the big red here, I say to the eligible states cannot cut their current Medicaid eligibility levels. So, and to be eligible for that increase in the FMAP.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Blewett, just for clarification on what is meant by eligibility levels, is this the number, who is eligible, or does it also affect the level of benefits we cover? Currently, Minnesota provides optional things and not required items on the benefit package. Is it benefits or just eligibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's just income eligibility levels is my understanding. So the optional, I don't think they've addressed the optional benefit issue. The perfect storm may be brewing is my conclusion. And these are just some examples from, since we don't have access to the more recent data, these are just some examples of headlines that we pulled out from the local newspapers. Here's Hennepin County Medical Center, an estimated $25 million. They estimate a $25 million in state funding drop and perhaps as much as $40 million over the biennium, which includes the federal dollars, which would disappear because of state cuts. We have North Country Health Services, which talk about Representative Huntley's point, which they have a higher load of Medicaid and medical assistance, and could the cost of community benefit rose from 5.98 to 7.5 million in 2008, which is the data that I did not have. A line of hospitals that eliminate 250 to 350 jobs through attrition, leaving positions open. That was October 4th, 2008. Fairview, cutting 150 to 200 filled positions. That was in October. Greater Minnesota, Rojas, with high numbers of public assistance patients could bleed under Governor Tim Pawlenty's proposed budget cuts. State hospital administrators, that's from Bemidji, Pioneer. Park Nicollet will cut 233 employees, or almost 3% of its workforce. That's December 2008. We can go on. University Medical School postponed their $200 million proposed building for outpatient care. Again, Hennepin County, this is more recent, January 26, 2009, cutting 100 jobs and freezing capital spending. Hazelden Foundation occupancy fell to 85%. Of their occupancy, which again, that's all out of pocket, mostly out of pocket for chemical dependency treatment. And also Mayo Clinic, has put up most of its construction and infrastructure projects. About 100 contract and temporary workers are being let go. The clinic patient numbers are steady, but that may change. So, you know, we could probably do three or four more slides of that. I'm sure you'll hear from the providers. I mean, I don't want to leave you with the message that things are rosy. I think things are starting to hit, and it's not going to abate in the short term. Silver lining, I always end my class on the healthcare system with a silver lining, because almost every class period is you end up being kind of frustrated with the healthcare system. But in Minnesota, our good health insurance coverage and our non-for-profit climate may have insulated us from an earlier impact, so I think that's a positive. A crisis is a time for thinking about a way to provide more efficient health care. We don't really have any money to waste. We need more price and cost transparency in the system. We need to know what we pay, where does the uncompensated care go, how much does it go, where. A really strong message to preserve the Health Care Access Fund. I think you're going to need it for health care needs for uninsured, unemployed, people losing their jobs. There's going to be a need for health care in this state. In the time of crisis, it's time to think creatively and think about different ways to do things. My colleagues at the university had, we met over lunch, and they have lots of ideas. I put them up here, but some are not mine, and they'd be welcome to come and explore any of these. One idea is eliminate the tax subsidy for the purchase of health care policies. So there's a tax subsidy, there's a significant amount of revenue there that goes to employers to provide health care. Or to be fair, add a tax credit for COBRA coverage. So right now those are taxable to individuals. Think about using the Health Care Access Fund, see what the federal government comes in to subsidy of COBRA as a possible add-on. Think about Health Care Access Fund to help hospitals who are facing significant amounts of uncompensated care. And then again, working towards improving efficiency and increased savings for access expansion. And then because my division director, Ira Moskowitz, vice is here, I have to talk about data and research from the university. One of the things we've been doing and think is important is to monitor the changing nature of health insurance coverage. So I think Minnesota's lucky to have that information on increase in co-payments or the deductibles in the individual and small group market. I think we're probably one of the only states that has that level of data. We don't have it for large employers. We don't have it for self-insured employers. So that's a place where you're seeing this more out-of-pocket spending on individuals. So that would be one place to think about monitoring what's going on with private coverage. Opportunity to right-size the healthcare system by putting more money in primary care. Think about the rural impact. We have some data, but not a lot of data. You probably get some good hospital data, but probably what's happening in rural Minnesota. And related to that, to monitor the strength and stability of the safety net, which is going to be the first line of coverage for increasing uninsured rates. And then think about what, if you're going to right-size the system or if you want the most efficient system, what would that look like? Do we have the most efficient system? If we're moving toward a most efficient system, how many hospitals, how many providers, how many primary care, how many specialists? Like, what would a most efficient system look like? So I thank you for the opportunity to testify. This is our contact information. We're always happy to come over and give you whatever information we can give. And happy birthday, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Blewett. Are there any questions for Dr. Blewett? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and happy birthday. And to Dr. Blewett, first time I've seen you today. On your last slide, and you're talking about the right size system, it's an intriguing thought, and I'm wondering if you'd have advice for a committee like ours on how on earth we would do that, please.
Dr. Blewett.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, you know, I think I was trying to look up, like, you know, what's the best hospital beds per thousand, what's the best primary care. I think there's some of that information out there. It's not readily available. Sort of what kind of mix of services. I mean, we've got, you know, really a lot of experts in this state, and maybe it's not what's your recommendation for health reform, but, you know, what would the system look like? I don't know, but I think we could put our heads together and kind of think about what it would look like and thinking about benchmarks on access to needed services.
I could, I'll bring my slide down the next meeting that shows the percentage of primary care people in the workforce in each individual state. North Dakota has the highest percentage of primary care, and Minnesota is number two. And that line you get when you rank all the states indicates that at least correlates with higher quality and lower costs based on the percentage of primary care physicians in that state. So, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy birthday again. on your slide 43, you say that our good health insurance coverage and nonprofit climate may have insulated us from early impact. I wonder if you could expound on that a little bit. You know, there's been a discussion over the last few years about whether we should have more for-profit insurers in our state and so on. And I wonder if you could just explain in what way the nonprofit climate may have insulated us.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that we could have a good debate on this. I think in general in a for-profit climate, in the past year, those companies have had to report to their stakeholders on a quarterly basis and make decisions in terms of cutting and keeping their profit margins up. In this state, we don't have that same kind of environment, and so they've had, you know, maybe somewhat of a grace period in terms of reporting to the state or reporting to their boards in terms of, you know, what's next for our healthcare system. So I think it's just a different kind of environment, and we've also had pretty decent, you know, profit margins, which don't go to the stakeholders, they go back into the system.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Dr. Blewett? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. And we'll go on to the next person on the list is Lawrence Massa, or Mesa, from the Minnesota Hospital Association, and he's relatively new president.
3.5 months, Mr. Chairman.
Well, if you could pronounce your name for the tape, then maybe I'll get it right.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committees. I'm Lawrence Massa, the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I'm here today representing our 147 hospitals and 17 healthcare systems throughout the state. Prior to joining the Minnesota Hospital Association as its president, I served as the CEO of Rice Memorial Hospital in Wilmer and have had the pleasure of testifying before your committee in the past. Representative Huntley and Thiessen have invited me and other representatives of Minnesota's hospitals to tell you today about the financial situation that we're facing and to comment on the governor's proposed budget. We certainly thank you for this important opportunity. We'll have some numbers that are slightly different from Dr. Blewett's. We've got some additional data that we've been able to get from our members that's a little more current, and we've used some different methodologies for making some estimates. So I'm sure as the session progresses, we will reconcile some of those numbers, particularly as we know more about the federal stimulus package. I know it comes as no surprise to you when I say that Minnesota hospitals are in a dire financial situation currently. As the Star Tribune recently reported, the recession has not spared the healthcare industry this time around. A recent MHA member survey looking at the third quarter of 2007 compared to third quarter 2008 showed that net income had fallen from the numbers that Dr. Blewett had shown for 2007 from third quarter 07 to third quarter 08. Net income had fallen from 4.8% positive to a negative 2.5%. And that's the net margin reported. And I can address the difference between an operating margin and a net margin. As we calculate our operating margin, that's the margin or the profit or loss that we make from direct care revenue versus our direct care expenses. The net margin rolls up things like investment income or, in the case of the current situation, investment losses and other non-operating sources of revenue. So that's the difference between those two numbers. The recession is having a negative impact on all of our hospitals, both rural and urban. Uncompensated care, and Dr. Blewett commented about this, which includes charity care and bad debt, is skyrocketing at our member hospitals. The chart on my left indicates the growth in uncompensated care, charity care, and bad debt from 2002 to 2008. That's got an additional year of data that was not available to Dr. Blewett in her presentation. Certainly, it continues to grow, and there is no question that the economy will cause it to grow further. Governor Pawlenty's proposed budget makes a bad situation painfully worse for Minnesota hospitals, threatening to cripple our ability to serve as the safety net in our communities. And Dr. Blewett addressed that role as well, as we provide care to everyone who comes to our emergency rooms. My second point today is to let you know that Governor Pawlenty's proposed budget cuts to hospitals will diminish care that we're able to give to our patients and communities. The reductions would likely result in hospitals having to reduce services that we have historically provided in our communities, particularly services that we've provided for no compensation or at below cost. Many community services like free blood pressure testing at health fairs and even education and training for our future caregivers could simply disappear. We urge legislators to balance Minnesota's fiscal problem by establishing a more broad-based cut to all areas of Minnesota's budget. In addition, it is important for legislators to consider that new revenue sources may be needed as part of the solution. For too long, we believe Minnesota's neediest and sickest residents have borne the brunt of unfair cuts to hospitals. That being said, I'd like to move on to address the governor's proposals regarding Minnesota care. When Minnesota Care was created in 1992, there was much controversy about the 2% provider tax, which was imposed to fund the program. While providers lost the battle against the tax, the provider community was promised that this money would go into a separate account called the Healthcare Access Fund, and that the money collected would only be used to cover the cost of the program. The program was established with the sole purpose of providing an affordable and subsidized insurance product for Minnesota's uninsured working poor, folks like the waitress who's working two jobs, the neighborhood barber, the entrepreneur just starting a small family business, and the farmer with no other health insurance alternative. But instead of paying for expanded Minnesota Care enrollment or reasonable payments to providers, the money in the Health Care Access Fund has been pirated away to balance the state's overall budget on several occasions. From fiscal year 2005 to 2009, by our estimates, $345 million has been taken from the Healthcare Access Fund and transferred to the general fund. This was not part of the proposal back in 1992. Today, we say enough is enough. Money meant to keep Minnesotans healthy and insured should not be used for that purpose, and it should only be used for the purpose as was originally intended. Unfortunately, the governor does not agree. The budget pages are a bit confusing, so I will highlight our take on the shell game that's proposed in the governor's budget. Number one, Governor Pawlenty is proposing the elimination of the Health Care Access Fund while keeping the 2% provider tax in place. In the budget pages that are in your book, that indicates that the 2% provider tax would raise some $698 million a year by fiscal 2013. He proposes to eliminate coverage for all adults on the Minnesota Care Program, taking 84,000 currently insured Minnesotans off of health insurance coverage under Minnesota Care. His proposal is to only cover children who meet income requirements, who are relatively cheaper to insure, driving the cost of Minnesota Care down to $101 million in fiscal 2013. Again, these numbers are in the governor's budget book. He then wants to take the remaining $597 million raised from the provider tax that should be used to cover adult enrollment or other program costs in Minnesota Care and uses the money in the general fund on a permanent basis. We believe this is wrong. The great human toll of an additional 84,000 residents without health insurance is clearly lost on the governor. Minnesota's uninsured rate, which has stood at about 8.7%, would rise by our estimates to 10.3%, representing an 18.7% increase in the number of uninsured in our state. Minnesota has been leading the nation with the highest percentage of our citizens with health insurance. We are now going backwards. I am fearful if these budget cuts move forward, Minnesota will also lose our high ranking as a high-quality, efficient health care provider state. People without health insurance, as was previously testified, typically delay seeking care until their health care problem deteriorates and becomes more costly to treat. In addition, they usually seek care in a hospital emergency room because hospitals are required to treat all patients with emergent conditions regardless of ability to pay. That is the essence of the safety net role hospitals play in their communities. However, as you know, care provided in emergency rooms is more expensive, which just increases the overall health care cost in the system. What will happen to Minnesota hospitals with this enormous influx of patients who can't pay their bills? The answer is painfully simple. Services will have to be cut and employees will have to be laid off. Over the past 6 months, by our estimates, Minnesota hospitals have laid off more than 1,568 employees. These layoffs have been across the board, including executives and administrative positions. Hospitals have done everything they can to preserve their direct care staff. Regretfully, more hospital layoffs may be forthcoming if the governor's budget proposals are adopted. Everyone is concerned about the job market and how to create more jobs. Since the Medicaid program has a dollar-for-dollar match, with the federal government sending Minnesota $1 for every dollar the state spends on Medicaid, perhaps the best way to preserve jobs in Minnesota is to protect the Medicaid budget. With the federal economic stimulus package nearing completion, we urge you to maximize the use of federal matching dollars to preserve health care for more Minnesotans and avoid more layoffs at hospitals throughout the state. The last point I would like to make is to address the issue of health care spending crowding out other areas of government spending, as Governor Pawlenty has stated. The Health and Human Services budget represents approximately 28% of state spending. 14 years ago, Health and Human Services spending as a percentage of the budget was at 25%, almost the same amount. State spending on health care is indeed growing, however, as the November forecast highlighted, but three-fourths of that increase is due to increased program enrollment, which only makes sense given the growing unemployment rate. Now is not the time to cut Minnesota's health care safety net. We have included in your packet, you should have a packet that's been distributed or will be distributed, we've included an analysis of the fiscal impact of the governor's budget proposal. The analysis estimates that we could potentially see $460 million in indirect cuts to hospitals due to the loss of eligibility of the 84,000 currently covered individuals on Minnesota Care, because we believe that they will have health care issues, they will show up at hospital emergency rooms, and we will provide care to them, which will only increase the uncompensated care burden to Minnesota hospitals. We've also identified $229 million in direct cuts to hospitals through targeted payment reductions. With federal matching dollars included in these numbers, the total impact to Minnesota's hospitals could be as high as $690 million.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't want to interrupt you as you were wrapping up here, but as long as we're stopping, I appreciate the fact that you're all here to tell us the impacts on the hospitals in Minnesota. I think that's vitally important for both of our committees. I'm hoping somewhere in your presentation you also help us with ideas about how we solve this problem if we're not to do it in the ways that the governor is suggesting. I think we need those ideas too.
Well, and I would refer to my earlier testimony that we believe hospitals are being singled out for larger proportions of the cuts, and so we would urge you to look at a more balanced approach to cuts. We understand that cuts are going to need to be made, and that would include the Minnesota hospitals, but we think that there should be a more balanced approach with everything being on the table, and we also would urge you to consider some additional revenue measures given the crisis that we're in. In sum, it must be understood that the hospital community in Minnesota has done more than its fair share in the past of shouldering state budget cuts. Last year, hospitals took $196 million in budget cuts, and in December, hospitals took one half of the cuts made in the unallotment process in the health and human services area. This time, let's take a fairer, more even-handed, and more caring approach that doesn't penalize the ill and injured among us. On behalf of Minnesota's hospitals, I implore you to find a solution that doesn't severely hurt our already fragile healthcare infrastructure and the people who depend on its crucial services. You will hear today from a number of hospital leaders and caregivers about these cuts, as well as the financial conditions currently affecting their patients and their organizations. Now I'd like to introduce two of the Minnesota Hospital Association leaders.
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. You can just help me with the math here. And I've had the privilege of listening to this dialogue for my 11th term now. And in 2003, we heard kind of a similar conversation from the hospitals. I'm puzzled, though, on the charts. Do you think Ms. Blewett's charts are correct?
I haven't really had a chance to look at Ms.
Blewett. You have to help me with it, not now, later. It says here that in 2003 you made money. And it says in the chart you gave us that you lost a lot of money, the underfunding effect. And so I'm curious about that. If not now, you can help me later on.
Representative Abler, Mr. Chairman,
yep.
The chart that you referred to here is not about overall margins. This is the amount of underfunding, the amount below cost that government programs are paying us. We've been able to make up the difference through cost shifting to people who have insurance and those kinds of things, and the ability to continue to do that will get increasingly difficult in today's world.
And I respect that. I'm just trying to reconcile all these different numbers. And the number I don't have, and I would like someone from the hospital group maybe to tell us in one of these meetings, is the total funding from hospitals, if it's gone up or down, and because we're sincere in helping solve your problem. I think that the more focused stay on the problem and the less on going after a person that put a budget proposal out that a lot of us don't like a lot of will be productive. Because this is going to be a problem never seen before by any of us. And, you know, I don't know what we're going to do, and it's going to be really a difficult time. Well, in 2003, and I'm trying to be helpful with your argument, we heard that there were cuts proposed to hospitals, and yet I look at this chart and I see that there's a profit margin, and I'm not mining, make a profit, it's America, you know, turn into new stuff and all that, but it's hard for me to understand how much money you're really getting. The other thing I'd like help with later is your chart for uncompensated care.
Yes.
Is about half the number of Ms. Lewis' chart. And is this based upon charges?
I believe it is based on charges, yes.
I'll just stop there. Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Massa. I had a brief conversation with one of your staff members last night, Ms. Stout. And so I want to, before you go to the other testifiers, I wanted to ask you, and then for the others from some of the hospitals that are going to testify, if you could maybe help us with a couple of questions. It would be helpful. So I have had a chance with Representative Rood to begin to talk with some of the hospitals in more detail about what they're facing. And, you know, it does sound to me like some of the hospitals are in precarious financial positions. And so
I hope that today, without making anybody feel like they're being exposed to standing here in their underwear, that if there are hospitals that are nearing that place of default or closing, if we could learn about that, I think that would be helpful. I also think, given the proposed governor's budget, but also because of the deficit, we know we're going to have to do some cutting, and it would be helpful for us, I think, to understand what cuts to hospitals would mean in terms of cuts to services and in terms of cuts to staffing. And then the thing that I think is important for us that might make you feel a little uncomfortable is that I think we need, as a committee and as the legislature, to understand and evaluate that over time. So if we go forward with the cuts that are being proposed and you have to cut services and staffing, what does that mean to patient care and patient safety going forward? And I would really like us to figure out how to evaluate that together so that we get a real picture of what's happening going forward.
I think there are a number of things that we are currently publicly reporting, and there will be more things that we publicly report regarding quality that came from the health reform legislation that you passed last year that should help us do that evaluation to see what happens to those numbers over a period of time. I guess we're trying to be proactive and try to ward off that before it happens.
Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Guest. I mean, I have real empathy for what you're going through, and you just brought up about 12 times, and that's what we're going through, trying to find the right solutions. But in terms of the earlier presentation by Ms. Blewett, I would like, if you could follow up, and you don't need to answer this now if you don't have it, but I'd like to generally have a better understanding how your industry is handling people with those high deductibles who don't have the $5,000 or the $2,000 in their savings account to handle those, what kind of payment plans or discount. And it used to be in the past that the only people who paid charges, full charges, were the uninsured, the self-payers, and that, you know, you'd give discounts to all your big insurers. They depend, they demand it. I understand that there's even now some referral sources that evaluate the quality of your care, and you can only get into the referral network as a quality provider if you agree to a discount. So, I mean, we're even mixing quality and price now together in the market. But I would really like to understand, so that we can put your bad debt and your charity care in perspective and the underpayment of the public programs, you know, what's the average discount to, you know, Medica and Health Partners and all the insurers, and how does that compare to the discount you have to absorb to take a Medicaid or a Minnesota Care or a General Assistance Medical Care patient? I know your finances are difficult, but the more we understand, the more that we'll be able to not only understand the impact of our decisions, but also translate it to the people who have never heard of it, who think charge is what everybody pays in the rest of the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, we will definitely work with you to try to get at all of those pieces of information. I can tell you that Minnesota hospitals, as a group, entered into an agreement with the Attorney General back in 2005, and we agreed to give the discount that we give to our largest insurance provider to the uninsured, so they up to income limitation of $125,000 a year. So the uninsured are getting the rate that our best health plan gets. I can tell you that we look at bad debt expense, it's going up. The hospitals are putting people on payment plans. It's taking longer for people to pay their bills. Bad debt is going up. Accounts receivable is going up at our hospitals, and that's limiting cash flow, and it's creating some issues for some of our members regarding days cash on hand and some of their bond covenants. And so that's, there's going to be some issues from that, and you may hear more about that today in further testimony.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, I'm particularly interested in what if they're paying full charges if they have a high deductible plan. I understand the situation with the uninsured, and I really appreciate that, and I appreciate your stepping forward on that. But for the people who have those high deductible plans, across the industry, what one can expect in terms of charge policy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, they would get charged whatever the contracted rate is with that insurance carrier. So if it's with Blue Cross Blue Shield, the high deductible plan, that person would get charged the same rate as a fully insured Blue Cross Blue Shield participant. So they get the discount.
Okay, that's helpful.
I would like to introduce my colleagues. Steve Perkins is a member of the board at Sanford Hospital in Luverne, Minnesota, and Deb Boardman is the president and CEO of Riverview Healthcare in Crookston.
We had one more question before you start. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is to you or to some of the follow-up testifiers. Back to some of the issues that Representative Abler raised. In conversations this last week and a half that many of us have had with financial officers and other representatives of the different hospital systems, we've talked about operating margins and where they are. The number that was often mentioned in those conversations is kind of the historical level, at least recent history, is more kind of the 3% range, and the Lynn Blewett slide of number 30 kind of shows a higher level than that historically, number one. Number two, they mentioned a figure currently of more like 1% and dropping. And so I would appreciate if today, if it's available in the room from someone in your presentations, to update that chart number on the slide number 30, and give, which only goes up to 2007, and give us a quarterly breakdown for 2008 in terms of what's happening to those operating margins in the last year and where they're, what the trend is. They went even further to say that they expect some of those to be dropping negatively, if not already real soon. So we want to hear about that from you all today. And the final point I want to make that you can comment on is when I came in the Dr. Blewett slide number 29 was up, the question I heard on the way in had to do with the issue of the uncompensated care and the cost shifting onto our premiums in the payer market. My understanding, again, from these conversations in the last couple weeks is that the ability to do that cost shifting has eroded tremendously in the last two or more years, but this is all anecdotal that I've been hearing. Basically, that's not going on anymore. So our old thought, well, you all can handle this because you'll cost shift and still have those operating ratios and profit margin, operating margin and operating ratios here in the positive may not only be true. So we do need to have, I think, going forward, more than just anecdotal on that, because as Representative was trying to get at least from this table up to 2007, you don't seem to be at great risk. And so we need to see where those trends are and what's happening to those two margins as of now. And I don't know what kind of evidence you can provide on the limits of cost shifting. Not that you would want us to know your capabilities in that area, but that's certainly something that's been at least behind the scenes, you know, part of the discussion historically. So whether you or just others that come after you, if you could address some of those issues in more detail, I'd be appreciated.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, we did a survey of our members comparing their third quarter in 2007 to the third quarter in 2008, and the margin had dropped from a positive 4.8% down to a minus 2.5%, and that was data from 110 of our 147 members. We are going to resurvey very shortly on the fourth quarter of 2008 because, as you know, the economy really, really crashed in October, and you can think about your own investment portfolio and the difference in terms of what it looked like on September 30th and what it looks like today. So we are trying to monitor those numbers on a quarterly basis. We'll have more data to share with you and the committee at future hearings.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, it's a happy birthday to you, by the way, too. And, Chairman Thiessen, it's good to see you again, too. I enjoyed our conversation, if you recall, last year when you were in Luverne, and there isn't too many state leaders that get out to that corner of the state, and so we appreciated that visit. And members of the two committees, my name is Steve Perkins. I'm chair of the Sanford Hospital Luverne Board, and I've served on that board for most of the last 23 years. In addition, I serve on the Minnesota Hospital Association Board of Directors, and I'm also chair of the American Hospital Association's Trustee Committee, which is called the Committee on Governance. In the interest of full disclosure, I tell you that today I'm a purely volunteer person. I've received no remuneration or reimbursement of any kind for diems other than some travel expenses for coming here. And my only interest in coming is as a community representative and one who's interested in seeing the betterment of health care, not only just for our community in Luverne and our area, but obviously for all of Minnesota. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and its members, I want to thank you for having this hearing and giving us an opportunity to express our strong concerns about the proposed cuts in the Health and Human Services budget. More specifically, I sincerely fear that Governor Pawlenty's proposed health care budget cuts would destabilize Minnesota hospitals and thereby further weaken Minnesota's economy in this time of recession and significant market instability. Hospitals in Minnesota have been steady and an important source of employment in our communities in both good times and bad times. And this is true whether you're looking at the metro area or out in the small communities in greater Minnesota. In 2008, Minnesota hospital employees Minnesota hospitals employed more than 100,000 people. During that time, they spent $6 million on employee compensation and benefits, and more than $3 billion in goods and services were purchased. Hospital goods and services and the payment to wages obviously is a significant part of the local economies and jobs in the communities, and those in turn, when you apply a multiplier effect, we at the Hospital Association believe supported more than $20 billion in economic activities in the state of Minnesota. So clearly it's a very significant part. Historically, hospitals continued to be a source of economic and job growth even during recessionary times. But I'm here as one today to tell you that this time is different. Hospitals are no longer recession-proof. In fact, hospitals in the Twin Cities area are demonstrating this time it is different. In just the past few months, you've read in the paper about more than 1,000 employees being laid off, and indeed, I think we'll be seeing some of that happening in the rural areas as well, particularly as we analyze the effects that the governor's cuts, if they were enacted, would have. In rural Minnesota, we're feeling the impact of the recession. Might lag a little bit in some communities. If you had a major employer with a layoff, obviously it's going to be more significant than maybe in a community that hasn't had any significant layoffs yet. Greater Minnesota hospitals are often the largest community employers. You know, in rural Minnesota, we struggle to attract and retain well-educated and professional residents, and rural hospitals are the one shining source that provides good, meaningful, well-paying jobs. For many years, we have seen nothing but cuts in government-sponsored healthcare programs. Reimbursement rates fall far short of the actual total cost of providing that service. Many of these in greater Minnesota are critical access hospitals, and they're feeling the strain of trying to serve a growing number of uninsured and underinsured who can't afford to pay for their health in services. We really don't have any declining enrollment problems in greater Minnesota in our hospitals. The situation, in fact, is the reverse. We're seeing an increase in business. And this situation, on top of the deep cuts from our state government, will force many of the more Minnesota hospitals to cut jobs and needed health care services. In fact, I'm quite sure that some will close if proposals like this are adopted. It's tough times, and it would only make it's tougher. Job loss and loss of services will be devastating to the impact of the communities. And I think, you know, if you can just imagine a community of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 10,000 people, and you lose your largest employer because of economic difficulties, what that means, particularly when they're the best jobs in the whole community. The ripple effects would be substantial in our rural economy. And let me add just one last comment. Minnesota's rural health care has a higher percentage of patients on Minnesota care, and this is one of the things that I think is most egregious about the governor's proposal. In fact, that percentage is 59% in greater Minnesota when you look at 41% in the metro area. So if the proposal to cut 85,000 adults from Minnesota care is implemented, our rural hospitals will see a dramatic increase in uncompensated care. I can tell you for the 9 Sanford hospitals in southwestern Minnesota, the impact of the governor's cut is nearly $9 million over the biennium. I can, if you divide that in two, I mean $4.5 million roughly a year, you know, you're looking in the overall biennium effect about $1 million impact per hospital. Mind you, 8 of these are critical access hospitals. I mean, they're small, many times an occupancy of 3, 4, 5, 6 patients. And, you know, to absorb those types of cuts, there's not any cuts you can make in a business that, and the hospital is a business, plus we're mandated by federal law to take people in. So what do you do in that situation? I don't know too many other businesses or government services that you're mandated to serve them, and you can't close your doors, even though you know they can't pay you. So that's about $1 million a hospital. And we just, less than today, but I don't know if that answers part of your question or not, but I mean, I think it is very significant. I can tell you out of that $9 million, that is clearly substantially more than our entire bottom line in those nine hospitals. And we're doing some checking, but I think it's about 2-1 as far as with the cut. So you take it from a slightly profitable situation, and you just take it right into the deep negative situation. That's tough when you're a small hospital to deal with. Already in our system, bad debt expense is going up. 32% for bad debt in the first 8 months of 2000, for the last 8 months of 2008 compared to 2007. And charity care is up 49% in those 8 month periods. Cutting Minnesota care will skyrocket uncompensated care as our small firm workers, our farmers, the self-employed, what do? They defer preventive care until something serious develops, and then they end up in the hospital emergency room where we've got the most expensive and they have no ability to pay, and we're left to work out uncompensated or payment arrangements or whatever we can do. But most of the time, your collection rate is extremely low in the single digit percentages. This will create significant, if not unbearable, financial strain for our rural hospitals. Our hospitals will be forced to eliminate critical services, and at worst, close their doors for good. Then we will see an even more economic strife in our rural communities. Clearly, this isn't the way that the great state of Minnesota should treat one of its most basic and essential needs for our citizens. Years ago, when I became a hospital trustee, I did it because I cared deeply about the quality of health care for myself and my family and my friends and all the people in our community in the state of Minnesota. While I fully understand that we have a massive budget problem, I hope that you remember, as you look at cuts to hospitals, particularly those in rural and greater Minnesota, that every dollar you cut, there really isn't a lot of expense sharing in the significant amount that we can go cut. Every dollar you cut really comes directly off that bottom line, and some of those bottom lines are negative already. And so you really push them hard, and I hope that you can remember that. And I implore you to consider the broader and the long-lasting effects and the actions that that this will bear the brunt on hospitals. We're going through other transitions, shortages of doctors, and trying to get the doctors in there. The hospital's always called upon to make up those financial packages to get a doctor or even a mid-level a physician assistant or nurse practitioner to come to your community. And if the hospital isn't making any money, it can't give anything in the into the package. And then, you're an 8-cylinder engine, now you're only operating on 7 cylinders. And then another doctor retires or goes someplace else and you've got 6 cylinders. Pretty soon the engine isn't running very well and the hospital suffers even more. And that's what leads to closing. And I'm seriously concerned that we will see that happen in greater Minnesota. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Perkins. And Representative Thiessen, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for coming today. That last point I think is a really important one that I hadn't thought about, but the effect of recruitment and how that affects the bottom line is something we really do need to think more carefully about. But my question had to do with, Stanford's a system of hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Are they each... Does each hospital stand alone in its finances, or is there a point at which, as a system, there starts to be decisions made about, we're going to reallocate kind of our catchment areas in a sense and close a particular hospital in the community to kind of balance out the cost among the rest of the hospitals? I don't know if you can speak to that or not, but
Cindy Morrison, our vice president for public affairs, is here, and she could answer that question better for you, I think. But really, to answer in our area of the nine that are in Minnesota, some are owned, like the Laverne system, and that was a community-based hospital which we sold to them about 5 years ago. The city did Worthington, which you recall was just purchased. That was a city-owned hospital. The rest are managed type facilities, and so they really aren't owned. Many are leased, but still involving the community, at least for a dollar, because healthcare is a pretty precious commodity out there, and there really isn't a lot of money to be made in it. So hopefully did that answer
that
your question a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ms. Boardman.
Hello. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm Deborah Boardman. I'm present Chief Executive Officer of Riverview Health in Crookston, Minnesota. We're a small rural critical access hospital located in the very northwest part of the state. And actually, after listening to some of the questions here today, my testimony is going to be more of a real personal experience, and I think we'll answer or give some insight into some of the questions I've heard here today. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today about our current financial situation in this time of recession and the impact of the state budget cuts that are going to have on our hospital. It was interesting for me to listen to Dr. Blewett's comments, and I think that we would be a living example of the trends that she talked about today. We are the largest employer not only in our community but in our county, and we're very proud of that fact. These are hard times for rural hospitals, and we don't expect it to get any better in the near future. Our auditors were just there for our annual audit to meet with our board, and as part of their presentation, they told us that we should plan the budget for a significant increase in our bad debt next year, which we had already significantly increased from last year. In 2007, our hospital experienced almost $1 million in bad debt, which was 1.7% of our gross revenue. In 2008, our bad debt increased to more than $1.5 million. This is 2.4% of our hospital's gross revenue. And in 2008, what this meant is that our bad debt was more than our total margin, or for the term that was used today, the net margin that hospitals have. So our bad debt was more than our total margin. We're anticipating that our bad debt is going to be more than 4% of our gross revenue next year, and this is a very disturbing trend to us. We need to consider, what do we do next? We've been able to hold our own. We've continued to make changes like everyone else, but we're now at the point where we're saying, if this was in fact to come true, what do we do next? I want to provide you with an example of a much-needed service that we're now taking a look at and saying, what do we do here? Last year, we began to serve people on a larger regional basis for chemical dependency. Now, chemical dependency isn't a very glitzy or a very positive service, but it's a very needed one throughout this entire state. Last year, being invited by other counties in our area because it's a very underserved area, we now have developed sites in Baudette, Roseau, Thief River Falls, East Grand Forks, and our primary site in Crookston. We serve them by doubling the size that we had provided over a year ago, which means we now have 14 detox beds, 28 residential inpatient beds, and 10 board and mod beds, which are the place that people stay when they have outpatient services and they don't have a local place to stay. We've seen a very dramatic increase in this need in the past year, just in our region. In admissions, for example, in our detox program, grew from 89 admissions in the fourth quarter of 2007 to 150 admissions in 2008. That's an 86% increase. Inpatient chemical dependency increased 51% in the same time period, from 51 to 77 admissions. And part of this is because we knew there was a pent-up demand, we'd done our work, and because of the areas that have asked us to come in and provide the service, and we now have more availability. But now what's happening is, as part of the governor's budget, they're talking about making some changes to the way that those services are reimbursed. Most public funding for chemical dependency comes from the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. And that fund pays for those, just like MA does or DMC for healthcare, it pays for those that don't have any of the resources to cover the service. There's a proposal to freeze these funds and to take away, basically, a hospital's ability to negotiate rates for the county. Now, this is on top, too, of course, of what's happening to our municipalities in the state. So this fund already pays us only a fraction of what it costs us to take care of these patients. And if more cuts come, we're going to have to really take a look at, is this a service we can continue to provide? The problem with this is not just the lack of availability of this service, but it's the circular problem that this causes. If that service isn't available, what happens is that last year we treated 240 people. This year we expect the number will be around 1,000 people that we will treat for chemical dependency. If we don't have the service there to provide it, what happens is these people end up in our emergency room. In many cases, they don't have the ability to pay for these ER services, and then our uncompensated care goes up. When your uncompensated care goes up, your finances become even more strained, and you have this circular problem going on, or you've had to cut a service to supplement the hospital that now bears the brunt of that additional uncompensated care. So it is a vicious circle that puts these people right in the center of it. There's a ripple effect because of economic costs, and for example, 8 years ago, our own Department of Health estimated that the human and economic costs associated with alcohol use amounted to about $4.5 billion annually. Now, that was in 2004, so that amount obviously is higher today. Other areas of society, such as public safety and law enforcement, also bear the cost of chemical dependency. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, every dollar that we spend on treatment saves $7 in the criminal justice cost. So to me, that's a wise investment up front. More and more of our community members are losing jobs, and their financial situations are such that they can't afford to pay for health care, just as you've heard today. I fear that if more of our community members lose that insurance because of budget cuts, it's only going to continue to make our hospital's financial situation worse. We care deeply about the community and our patients, and I implore you to consider the poor and newly unemployed people who will suffer the most if the legislature wields the Budget Act as a program that provides us much-needed care. At Riverview, we serve a large number of patients who are on Minnesota Care, Medical Assistance, and Prepaid Medical Assistance Program, or PMAP. In 2008, we served about 5,000 people with autism in these programs. I fear that our community's fiber is going to be ripped wide open with the suffering that our people will experience when they realize that the healthcare safety net of their hospital can no longer provide this help. We can do better for our citizens who are already reeling from the hard hits of this recession. Patient care and accessibility are bound to suffer if more cuts are made to healthcare. I'd just like to comment on two other questions that I've heard today, and I know there's a lot more data that the Hospital Association can provide you. But one of the questions was, has total funding for hospitals gone up or down? And I think one of the things that if you look at this and think about it, I don't remember, Lori, you could help, but what year is our Medicaid number based on now? Is it 2002 or 3?
2002 costs.
Sorry, 2002 costs are what our Medicaid rates are based on now. So I think that you may look to see that hospitals are getting in aggregate or in total more money. It's because we're serving more people. It's not because you're paying or Medicaid is paying us more per patient to provide the care. And think about what our costs have risen since 2002. We certainly are not operating on 2002 costs to provide the care. So that's a discrepancy there, certainly. And the other question I could comment a little bit on was the actual amount of cost shifting and if we're, are we able to recoup that through our private insurance company? In most of our insurance contract negotiations, what they do when we come to an agreement, they will lock in for us what kind of increases we can give to them. So in other words, let's say we feel we need to raise our rates 10% to cover the shortfall in the other areas. By contract, if we've negotiated with Blue Cross, Medica, or whoever else, they may say to us, you can raise your rates whatever you like, but we're only going to give you a 3% increase. So the answer to that is, can we make it up? No, we can't. So those would just be a couple of my comments on those specific questions today, but I'd be happy to try to answer any others in the meeting.
I have a question. What percentage of your patients are on Medicare, Medical Assistance, Minnesota Care, or GAMC?
Overall, it's about in the 65% range.
Thank you.
Yep.
And Mr. Perkins, if you'd answer the same question.
I'd have to
if
check.
You know.
I'd have to check, but I think we're about 65-70% as far as particularly Medicare and Minnesota Care.
And are either one of you a critical access hospital?
We are, yes. Both
of us are. Okay.
Other questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Massa. I was wondering, I got a question today whether or not, whether Minnesota is going to be eligible for some of the proposed stimulus money. In the House version, there's a that some states may not qualify because of something that's called a prompt pay provision that would, if we're not in compliance with that, we wouldn't be eligible to get the money. The Senate version doesn't have that. Do you know, are we currently compliant, and what does that really mean?
I don't know the answer to that question. As we've looked at the two bills, as they work their way through, we believe that we're going to be eligible for those dollars, but that prompt pay requirement, I don't know the answer to, and we'll have to look at that, and we can certainly get back to you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the last few testifiers, I rattled off a bunch of questions before we started testifying, so I'm just wondering if we proceed, what you think you might have to do in terms of cuts to programs, where you might have to look in terms of cuts to programs or staffing, if you can give us a little bit of, I know you don't have your strategic plan prepared, but if you give it at least some ballpark about what that would mean in your communities, that would be helpful to me and probably to the committee.
I can make a few general comments. As you say, we don't have a plan in place yet fully.
certainly when we go through this process, one of the things we take a look at is what are your basic services that you need to provide to the community. In our case, it would certainly be the emergency room, the primary care, and the inpatient services. Anything other than that is really on the board to be taken a look at is what does that mean. Again, when you talk about, in our case, being the largest employer in the community, and you take a look at how many times the salaries turn over in the community and those kind of things, it has a huge economic impact, not only to our community, the people who work there who might be affected, but to our region as a whole because of the goods and services that are purchased, et cetera, et cetera. In general, again, because we don't have a plan, I think anything that isn't integral to being part of what we are the things that you cut. When you talk about all the stuff that's going on with healthcare reform and baskets of care and chronic illnesses and those kind of things, those are the kind of things we really have to take a look at is can we, in a rural community, really do the things that need to be done for all the pieces of diabetic care. Those are things that are not well reimbursed, and so now we'll be looking to sending those people many, many miles for those services.
And I think in Laverne, we would look at many of the same things. I mean, the estimate that the Hospital Association has said is a little over $1 million for the Laverne facility. So, I mean, obviously, I'm not the tactical guy. I'm on the board. So, but we would, I mean, that would have a very significant and material effect on the services that we can deliver in the community if we've got to go cut $1 million off the budget. And I am convinced that all those cuts come right to the bottom line, too, because you can't cut services. You know, if we had declining enrollments, we could maybe lay off a few janitors and teachers or something, or if we had, LGA cuts or something like that, maybe we could plow streets a little less often or whatever. But when you're obligated by law to have everybody that shows up and serve them, I mean, you can't close it. So I can't answer your question specifically, but it won't be a very pleasant task, and I don't think people will like it when they see services, essential services cut, you know. And I'm not one that's just opposed to, you know, instead that wants to come out and say, we can't cut here, we can't. I've been in business, and I've had to make some cuts. I've had to lay people off, and had to have tough union negotiations and everything else. But we're just trying to be honest and direct and candid with you that this would be more than just cutting a little fat off the budget. I think we're down into the lean pretty far.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony, and I'm sure a representative leader would like to say hello to Ms. Boardman, as well as my daughter-in-law, who's from Crookston.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we're going to go out of order because the next speaker, Jen Malcolm, has to leave shortly. And and I think we have a quorum, or we've had a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order. And I was going to say commissioner, but Ms. Malcolm, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much, and thank you to the members of the committee. And I appreciate being able to go out of order. I am the former commissioner of health and still honored by that title. I am the chief executive officer at Courage Center, and I would like to just share with you today a couple of comments that I think are probably going to be a little different from what you're hearing from many of my colleagues in the healthcare system who can speak to much larger numbers. So I represent a population of folks smaller in numbers but very significant in terms of the cost of their care in the state and the significance of what you are considering in terms of the impact on their health and independence and quality of life. I want to tell you just a little bit about the economics of our business at Courage Center. We serve about 11,000 people a year, and our total revenue base is about $42 million. That's as of last year, our last business year. About two-thirds of that budget comes from reimbursed services and about one-third from philanthropy. Of our reimbursed healthcare services, and we provide medical therapies as well as a range of social services, fully about half of that comes from state public programs and a little bit from Medicare. But for a significant part, we provide rehabilitation therapies to people covered by public programs, either at the time of their illness or injury or subsequent to their illness or injury. A great majority of our folks are served by public programs at some point in their lives. The loss margin for Courage Center on those public programs is fully about 50%. So that's where the philanthropy comes in, as well as the cost shifting that you've heard about from other health providers, from
subsidizing the loss on public programs off to commercial and private health plans, although we certainly understand the counter pressures from their point of view. That's one of the areas in which they hope to control costs for their private sector clients, is by addressing the cost shifting that occurs in the reimbursement structure under public programs. I mentioned the importance of philanthropy. That is what has made Courage Center, frankly, work and be a resource in this community for 80 years. That bargain is shifting and really needs to be revisited, and I think there really needs to be clarity across the public sector and the philanthropic sector about what we're really asking each of those sectors to do in terms of paying for core services that our community values. I'll come back to that in just a moment. Now I'd like to give you a sense of the economic impact of what we do, just in one of our programs. We run an inpatient rehabilitation unit. We call it our transitional rehab program. It is licensed as a skilled nursing facility, but it really occupies a very unique place in the whole continuum of health services. It's really sort of halfway in between a hospital inpatient rehabilitation unit and a more traditional skilled nursing facility. We serve folks with a higher level of complexity, a much more therapy-intensive environment. We serve about 170 people a year in this inpatient program. And I'd like you to know, and you should be proud of this, that this is a level of care that is somewhat unique to this community. There aren't other Courage Centers. There aren't other inpatient programs like this anywhere in the country. And that is a testament to our success in Minnesota historically at having robust programs that value the return to health and independence for people with disabilities and this generous philanthropic community that I've already mentioned. So just in this one program, in our inpatient program, I'd like to just give you a sense of what would happen if this program wasn't here. I mentioned we serve about 170 people per year in this program. If there was no Courage inpatient program, transitional rehab unit, if those clients had to stay in an acute hospital setting until they were able to be discharged to their home setting, that would have cost the system an additional $8 million a year. So if there was no capacity to move those folks out of hospital into the Courage Transitional Rehab Unit, $8 million a year in additional hospital-based rehabilitation costs that the system would have incurred. If those clients were discharged not to us, but from a hospital to a skilled nursing facility with less intensive therapy, so they're not going straight home, but they're going to a more traditional skilled nursing facility environment, optimistically, perhaps a third of those people could be discharged home after a year without the kind of intensive therapies that we're able to provide in the Courage Transitional Rehab Program. Those remaining in the skilled nursing facility stay there at an added cost of $4.5 million a year. So we can either pay for it in more hospital care or more skilled nursing facility care or in just less services provided, leaving the people who are affected in a condition of either permanently staying in a nursing facility without the ability ever to be discharged back to a more independent living setting, or to be discharged to home but at a very, very reduced ability to function and participate in the life of the community. If folks do stay permanently in a nursing home, we know the data from the Department of Human Services that staying in a long-term care facility comes at a cost of about $57,000 a year versus the cost of maintaining a person in the community with appropriate home and community-based supports is about $17,000 a year. So we think we can show you how we add value, and if you look at the whole continuum of care in a program like the Courage Transitional Rehab Unit, in avoided hospital stays, avoided nursing home stays, and all of that adds up to, we think, a healthy contribution to the economic impact. Now, for that performance, we lose about $1.7 million a year on this one program. So there's the economics of this don't work so well under today's current healthcare reimbursement system. You've already heard, and I'm sure you'll hear more from other speakers, about the critical importance of continuing to move ahead with healthcare reform, trying to look at the whole continuum of care, trying to figure out how do we best manage the total cost of people with complex needs across these multiple points of care. These are the kind of economics that we think make it compelling for you in the legislature to continue to move in the direction of rewarding the right care, the right place, the right time,
to help avoid what otherwise would be spent elsewhere in the system. Now, philanthropists look at data like this and suggest that that's the very reason that government should be reimbursing and reimbursing appropriately for these services, and are saying more and more they're not in the business of paying for things that it makes great good sense for the government to pay for. So we're seeing a very definite shift in the philanthropic community, particularly for the large foundations and the institutional funders who do not feel it is a proper use of their dollars to be subsidizing what in their mind is strong evidence-based results of the appropriate healthcare services that should be provided under the state's public program. So I've just have been talking with you about this one inpatient program as an example of the far larger array of services that we provide at Courage Center, and the economic impact on the clients we serve and on the community as a whole of successful rehabilitation means people able to work, people able to live independently, people able to have jobs. This happens today to be our day at the Capitol. We're here today with about 150 of our clients and staff and volunteers, and I hope some of you have had a chance to visit with some of our folks. This morning we were all together, and they spoke so eloquently about their desire to work and their pride in being able to work and being able to recover from an illness or an injury and to be able to contribute to the community. Their voices are much more eloquent than mine on that score. I find it stunning to know, I don't know if you know this data, but apparently Minnesota is the best in the country when it comes at employing people with disabilities. We should be proud of that. But our unemployment rate for people with disabilities is 55%. So we're the best in the nation, and over half of our citizens with disabilities of working age who want to be working are not able to do so. So the economic benefit of investing in the kind of therapies that allow them to apply their skills and their talents and their drive to contribute is another economic impact that I'd ask you to bear in mind. For Courage's program, our vocational rehabilitation services, just for the 242 people that we've been able to help over the last couple of years in tracking their success in having jobs, those 242 people alone have succeeded in earning $4.6 million over the last 2 years. Income to them helps to avoid their dependency on public programs and helps to make them tax-paying members of society, which even beyond the economic impact, the human dignity impact of that is important to us all. But the avoidance of secondary complications and the avoidance of future debilitating health care costs is where we think the real economic impact of rehabilitation services across the community are. And we're all working hard in the disability community and in the healthcare community to try to get our arms around a better capture of what that secondary prevention is really worth. Finally, I'll just leave you with another kind of a point, which might be different from what you're hearing from other speakers here today. And that is understanding the connectedness between many of these issues. And let's just talk for a moment about the population of folks with brain injury and the correlation between an important issue like homelessness and brain injury. We have data out of the Wilder Research Institute that suggests that about 35% of the long-term homeless in our state, in fact, have a brain injury. And that's perhaps part of the reason why they are chronically homeless. If that's the case, that about 35% of that population has a brain injury, we know that the cost of chronic homelessness is about $40,000 a year in terms of to fund their temporary shelters and their health care costs that are incurred as a fact of being homeless. Those 3,000 people about who we suspect have a brain injury who are chronically homeless are costing the system $121 million per year. So it's kind of a classic case of pay me now or pay me later as we think about these safety net kinds of functions and the need to invest and the opportunity to invest, I should say, in the kinds of services which might be found in the healthcare sector which pay off in avoided other social costs, such as chronic homelessness or even corrections. This is just a small snippet, Mr. Chair and members, of the kind of data that we can come up with when we look in a more holistic, connected way at the costs of the problems being borne by people with significant disabilities, where their costs are showing up and elsewhere in the system, and where we have a real chance to save dollars for the state and to improve quality of life for these citizens by doing the right kinds of primary and secondary services and preventive care. I thank you for your attention. We'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Malcolm? Don't see any, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we'll move right along because we don't have too much time left. Bert Norman from Essentia. Yeah. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just state your name for the tape, so that when this is transcribed, they'll know who's talking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and happy birthday. My name is Bert Norman. I'm from Essentia Health from Duluth, and I represent both the St. Mary's Duluth Clinic Health System and St. Joe's Medical Center in Brainerd, Minnesota. I am a chief financial officer of a health system that provides services in rural Minnesota. And there are two segments of healthcare providers in rural Minnesota, one of which is critical access, which the government, through the Medicare program, gives a safety net in that it's a cost-reimbursed methodology. And then the larger systems are under the prospective payment system, and they get our revenues by contracts and others. So we're one of the larger rural providers. We have over a 100-year tradition of caring for our communities. The Duluth market is a 500,000 population region that we serve the Arrowhead region of Minnesota and the northeast of Wisconsin. Our Brainerd area is about 115,000 population in central Minnesota. We, like the speakers before you, have a poor payer mix, in that we serve over 60% of our patients are from the government payer sector. And the MHA has projected that the cuts that are affecting the Duluth market is about $36 million, and of that, 27 is the St. Mary's Duluth Clinic Health System, and another $9 million for our competing facility at St. Luke's. And the Brainerd market is impacted by about $9 million. And these are large numbers for an organization that serves the poor and the powerless. We meet our community needs, the defined geography I talked about, and we provide mental health. And when you look at the mental health, both organizations, the St. Mary's Duluth Clinic organization and the Brainerd St. Joe's Medical Center, have mental health and behavioral health services in both markets. And when you look at the behavioral health market in particular, both of our inpatient units serve populations throughout Minnesota. If you do a scattergram of where these individuals and families that we serve, they don't just come from our geography, they come throughout the state of Minnesota. And mental health patients, unfortunately, there are too few providers of mental health services, and when you look at the payer mix of the mental health population, over 70% of them are either Medicaid or Medicare.
Mr. Brodman, maybe you used to know, or Mr. Norman, rather. What percentage of the Duluth beds are filled, mental health beds filled with people from the Twin Cities? I used to know that number, but I
forgot. Yeah, we've looked at it over the last, say, 4 years on an average. We serve 12% of the patients in the last 4 years. I don't have recent data as to whether or not that thing is increasing. I can tell you in the Brainerd market, it's gone from 12% to 18% in the last 12 months. So we're seeing more evidence of the need from the metro area coming into our facilities. It's 15%. 15%.
So these are, in many cases, people can't get into a mental health bed in the Twin Cities, and so they're sent
right
to other parts of the state.
Now, on a fully loaded basis, our two health systems incur about a $7 million loss to provide behavioral health services in our two markets. And we do that because it's our mission to do so, and we're proud of that. As it relates to some of the proposed cuts you're considering, one of which is the 6% rateable reduction for mental health inpatient services. And these cuts would affect our two health systems by about $1.5 million. So we're losing seven, we're going to get cut another $1.5 million of revenues if these cuts go forward. And in the past budgets, and I know this is a very trying time, the mental health area was excluded from these rateable reductions. And I believe that there are too few providers in the state, as evidenced by the demand for our services. In fact, a lot of times we are on divert, and because we have to take all comers from all anywhere who calls us, there are sometimes our beds are full and the people in our own community can't get these services, and then we have to try to find services somewhere else. And so I think that that's a mistake, and I ask for your reconsideration of the mental health part of your situation. And I understand the magnitude of the budget cuts you're talking about, but I want to talk about that one in particular. Another cut that is being proposed is the elimination of the provision which seeks to address the disparity of reimbursement based solely on geographic locations. And this provision is referred to in your analysis as the 16 DRG add-on. And this results in a step backwards in my view, because the reimbursement for the same services provided whether you're in the metro or not is not necessarily reimbursed the same. And what you've attempted to do through other times is to get that disparity dealt with. And by eliminating that, it affects St. Joseph's alone by $400,000 and SNDC another $1.3 million. And we thank the legislature for its ability to recognize that this is an inequity and the attempt to try to address it. And we think by eliminating it, it just goes back to where we were several years ago. The economic downturn has affected everyone's financial health, including our own retirement accounts when we look at what's happened. And the fact is, it's also affected the health care. Because what's unique about health care is that we are a safety net for our communities. And to be credit worthy, the objective of any health system is to be able to meet its community needs. And the thing that we try to do is be able to access low cost debt by having a healthy balance sheet that can go to the credit markets and do more community good. And the truth is as the economy has weakened, the balance sheets of our health systems have been weakened, much like our own individual accounts. And so when you look at our organization, at the beginning of this fiscal year, which is July 1st, we had about 96 days cash on hand. And we have debt covenants related to this ability to get low-cost debt and be able to access that in the future. And as the market has done the unthinkable in the last 4 months and declining 30% on the S&P, the truth is we, and me as in particular as a finance person, is entrusted with these assets. St. Mary's Medical Center came into existence 120 years ago, and St. Joe's came in existence 100 years ago, and we carry on the tradition of our sisters that created these health systems. And the truth is that if you look at what we do in terms of trying to balance this revenue and expense, and you've heard today this stress upon bad debts rising and all this, and I know that it's a difficult decision you all have to try to figure out what's going on. The stress of what's going on here is the shifting of the burden to us as a healthcare community is now we're at the thresholds of certain covenants. And when you have covenants, that means you cannot go below them. And it's all that means is that when there are reductions, we have been operating as a health community on an inflation highway for years. And the truth is we've made decisions of entering into 3-year contracts with unions, for instance, to provide a cost of living over a three-year period of time, not knowing that this economy was going to do what the unthinkable has done. And the fact is, the Dow is down 400 points as I speak, and it's a difficult situation when we are at the covenants of what we are. We have to know the impact that this has on the safety net of providing healthcare services in our community. So as you look at reducing our revenues, that is one thing you're going to have to do. At the same time, we can't shift the burden to the community commercial payors, because their unemployment, they're seeing their rent sales go down, and the cost shift that was required by your cuts is unsustainable. And we've entered into commitments that we now cannot meet. So what's happening is that we have to make reductions. So in our community, we've had to, we saw declines in our volumes over a year ago. And we looked at our plans and we thought we were on this growth thing, and we had to cut 260 FTEs out of our health system, okay? And 50 of them were in the management area. Now, we think we did that responsibly, and we did that with voluntary turnover. We've also implemented salary freezes for our administration folks, for our physicians, for our non-contract employees. What happens if that isn't enough and these costs rise and revenue stays here? How are we going to solve the problem as a healthcare community? And that's what we're up against, and that's what we will have to do. We've frozen our capital. We blame it on the banks that they have no ability to lend. The truth is, we shouldn't be borrowing right now because it's too costly and too expensive. And we need this market to balance itself. So we must meet our financial commitments. And given the impact of these investment losses that have occurred, we are now daily monitoring our situation. So I beg you to take all this into account. I'm not being overreactive. These are serious times in healthcare. I think for the first time, because we have gone through this, we've been immune to these downturns in the past, this is different. And that's what I have tried to share with my organization, that we need to do something different, which is why we're taking these drastic steps to try to reduce our healthcare inflation, and I'm hoping that that's enough. And if it's not, then we're going to have to find the answer somewhere else.
Thank you, Mr. Norman. Are there questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Norman, for your candor. Can you share with the committee what would be next for you if we're not able to, if we go down the path of further cutting?
Well, we're committed to our mission. Like, we have the 100-year history. And I'm not, I don't want to use anything as a threat. On the other hand, if we have services that we can't support, and kind of like what Deb had just shared in her testimony, there are certain core services we need to get to, and in a crisis, you've got to go to the core and go to what you need to do. My fear is that we go after areas of the most need, like behavioral, and eliminate some of, where are these people going to go? And to me, it's unconscionable how we're underfunding that area already, and let alone adding another cut on top of it, just seems overkill to me. And so I want to stay in those businesses because there's such a need for it. But that's one of the areas. The other thing is, we're looking at all non-core services. We're jumping onto the Toyota bandwagon and lean manufacturing principles, trying to re-engineer how healthcare gets delivered. We're looking at chronic disease management and trying to figure out a new way to deliver chronic disease in it with a care model that makes sense for us. We're doing all these things knowing in the end it's going to be different, but we better get on the business of trying to find a more efficient care delivery model, and that's what we're trying to do, knowing full well we just can't borrow it by asking, you know, money all the time. But I tell you, right now, we're shifting our thinking from the old to the new, and that's where I think we're in such difficulty.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Norman. I just want to say that, first of all, really, we appreciate your passion on this. I mean, you're very compelling. I just want to say that, you know, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
I mean, the same things, the same dynamics that you're describing are the ones that we're facing as a state. And our job is going to be really, I mean, there's going to be no way to avoid cuts. We all know that.
Right.
And it's a matter of how can we do the least harm.
That's correct.
And so, you know, I appreciate putting your case here and explaining some of this to us. I mean, we are going to be doing harm. Mm-hmm. There's just no way to not do harm in the situation that we're in. And mm-hmm. I just hope that we can kind of dig down deep enough into each area so that we can figure out, as I say, how to do it with the least time.
Right, and as more people become unemployed, and you think about when we just started our professions mm-hmm. and we had no cash in a first job and we tried to live on that paycheck, we were dependent on that paycheck. And as security's cash, and if cash gets close to the threshold and you really can't burn it, that means you have to act on it. And that's what organizations are being asked to do. We are in it together, and we understand. I understand the plight in which the state is in. I just wanted to make sure that you understand the true reality. This is different. I mean, unfortunately, with the professor's information of 2007 is a little different than 2009. I mean, the S&P 15 months ago was at 1,500, and it's at 829.62 as I speak. You know, 828. It's crazy. And that's the reality of healthcare, is that we are dependent. Because, you know, healthcare has to generate cash flow some way. And we've relied on these investments for too long. And when we've gotten them taken away, it's exposed our vulnerability.
Well, thank you, Mr. Norman, for your testimony. And these are different times. The thing that struck me the most this fall is being with a group of nurses that were in their, don't want to give their ages, but they, a number of them had daughters starting to graduate from nursing school who couldn't get jobs. This was in November, and in July, any nurse in Minnesota would have had 10 job offers. So things have drastically changed. So thank you for your testimony, and next we'll have David Westner from Park Nicholas.
Good afternoon, Mr.
Welcome,
Chairman.
Committee.
Happy birthday. and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you that I hope will be helpful, as I know you're working very hard to deal with a difficult situation, a truly frightening economic situation that affects everyone. And I don't envy your work and the sort of decisions that you need to make. As you know, however, the pressures are everywhere, and they are being expressed in a lot of different ways. It's beyond comparison with what we have seen before. As we look forward into the next year and look at the challenge of serving the community, I have to say that we were quite shocked by the governor's budget, as it really focused a great percentage of the state's total economic stress onto vulnerable populations and healthcare organizations. So there was a bit of a funneling, I believe, towards the healthcare organization, given the fact that a large part of the state budget is made up of healthcare costs. That is well known. But the effect of focusing that effort is something that really is significant. The net effect of that on Park Nicollet is about $11.5 million. But before I describe that, I think you need to understand that this is in a context where we have been growing the amount of care that we have been providing for people without compensation very, very significantly, and it now threatens our ability to continue to do that. And in your materials, you have something that looks like this. If you could pull that out. This is a picture of this, of something that has been described by a number of the people giving testimony as being the percent of government payment. And we call this sort of the boiling frog phenomenon, because what we have seen is two factors that have accelerated over time. One is the percent of the people we care for that are being paid for by government payment. And so that has been growing. It is currently 40.7. And I'm including both Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and Medicare in this combination. Add to that the fact that the percent of costs, and I'm not talking about charges here, I'm talking about costs, the percent of costs have been that payment represents have been dropping as well. Now, we all know that health care costs too much, and that is a significant problem. I'll say that these numbers are based, however, that the Park Neglett Methodist Hospital was recently recognized on a short list of 12 hospitals nationally as being one of the highest value hospitals. So that's an employer group that looks at the question about quality and value. And so we've been working on trying to take waste and cost out of the situation. I feel that's very important. But as these cuts occur, the costs don't go away. In comparison to a lot of parts of the economy that in this time of contraction and everyone pulling back to the core, that demand is dropping, we are seeing that the responsibility that actually demand from these populations that are served will be going up as they grow and in the number of people that are so affected. So as those costs continue, we continue to serve them. And so where government is pulling back from these responsibilities, the not-for-profit healthcare organizations remain open with an open door and are continuing to care for that. We are required to, at least our emergency departments are, but we are required to keep an open door, and so we are doing that. But that cumulative burden is very significant. We have to provide, and we do that by providing access pre-care. We have about $8 million of pre-care annually that we provide, some of that organized as free clinics. We run 10 of those. Our bad debt has grown in the past year by $6.4 million, up to $25 million. And we've seen a 15% increase in terms of patient responsibility, where the bill itself this year is the patient's responsibility. So those are some of the changes that we've seen. Where perhaps there is a reluctance to tax for these costs, we are in fact taxing. So we talk about the hidden tax or in healthcare and the fact that government underpays costs. Then these same organizations are without authority and without a fee or a budget taxing the rest of the system by negotiating higher rates, and that looks like higher health care costs. But this responsibility of doing this hidden tax to cover uncompensated care is another task taken on by not-for-profit organizations. And so that is another responsibility. And to the extent that the true cost of care is not paid for, we make up that difference. And so that looks like this chart, and it's a little bit like that one. It represents the same thing. But this is not a cell phone ad. This is the growth in uncompensated care that we've seen. And so without cuts this year, without a change, without the cuts that are proposed in the governor's budget, you see the far right there that there is a $21 million increase in uncompensated care at Park Neglett. that we need to cover. That's without cost. Now, on top of that, we expect bad debt to increase again, probably by about $6 million, and if you would take the annual effect of the cuts itself would be another six. So we would be over $30 million of increased uncompensated care in 2009 over 2008. Now in 2008, we lost money. We lost about 1.2%. It was a quite a drop, and our total losses for the year, that was $14 million from operations that we lost, and our total losses for the year were $148 million. And that comes from accounting for the loss in our investment portfolios, which has helped to support this care, for one thing, and we were also, because of the failure of our bond insurer, AMBAC, we were forced to refinance. And so we had to also write off the cost of our financing. As a result of these events, we find ourselves tripping bond covenants. So we're looking at that today and actually see that our ability to cover our bond bond service, debt service, is below the recommended rate of 110%. So we're below that. And so we've officially tripped that. We know of other organizations that are also tripping bond covenants. So as you think about this issue, then what's at risk is the $166 million, soon to be $190 million of uncompensated care that organizations like ours provide to support health care access in our communities. And that's being threatened by the current economic situation and exacerbated by the recommended cuts that are being proposed. Now, what to do about it? I've made your problem worse, perhaps, by sharing this information. And you've asked what to do about this particular thing. First of all, my advice would be that we, first of all, do not walk away from federal money. It may be our Minnesota humility that we don't feel we deserve it, but we are at the lower end of getting federal money, and so we are the losers in that, and we should at least be smart enough to engineer our total budget in a way that takes advantage of every federal dollar we can. That's the least we can do for our citizens is make that happen. Secondly, we need to spread the burden, and that is if we focus all of this economic pressure on the most vulnerable and on the organizations that are spanning this gap, we can do real damage and actually threaten the whole system. And so we actually have a method that has already been devised to spread the load. It's called the provider tax, and it creates a healthcare access fund. And so that was the intent of that tax. That was the preconditions under which it was agreed to. And it needs to be used for its purpose, especially in these times, to cover these gaps. And then thirdly is get on real for reform. The trajectory of healthcare costs is wrong, but it isn't going to get solved through simply cutting payment levels. Is not going to create reform. It is anything, it's going to create perverse actions, not the right kind of actions. And so the work done last year, which was good progress, needs to go on. And we need to get to a system that allows us to pursue serving our communities in a manner that aligns everyone's interests. And that is a system problem. I do not feel that when we talk about the healthcare system, that this is because we have bad people or people that aren't bright enough to get it right in this country. We have a bad system, and we need to get on to fixing that if we're going to avoid this type of pressure and this sort of unmet need. So I thank you for the opportunity to share some data with you. I hope it's helpful and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wessner. Are there questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and greetings. I'm wondering if you could just share with me or the members of the committee what happens when you're unable to cover your debt service. I mean, you told us that. I appreciate that. But it would be helpful for us to understand what that means in a practical sense.
Yeah, it's not a, in this case, it's not a technical default, but it is a tripping one of those covenants, so it gives the bank the opportunity to bring in a consultant to rearrange priorities and shore it up. So that is the technical response to that, but clearly we are in a position where we need to find ways to cut costs and to contract support. And in doing so, we will try to remain as accessible as possible, but we've already laid off over 230 people. We are looking at what is necessary and how we can confer the contract services or contract costs and still provide essential services. So that's the challenge that we have right now, is how to do that. How do we contract successfully and yet not abandon our mission in the community?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You also mentioned in your testimony that you suspect that you're not the only system that is in the position of not being able to cover debt service or tripping that. And I know you can't testify on behalf of others, so I appreciate you sharing that with us as well, and I hope that if others find themselves in that place, that they will at least share it with us confidentially. So we need a good picture, I think, of what we're facing in Minnesota. And so I appreciate your candor. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your being here also and all of the testifiers. It's really instructive to hear you. One of the questions, though, the threads that I've run through this is that on the Healthcare Access Fund, if that were not used for anything else in the general fund and only for the things that have so far been testified to, that if we use that Healthcare Access Fund only for these areas, would it fill the holes? Would that be enough to fill those holes?
I'm not your best expert on that question as to exactly what... my belief is it would probably not fill all these holes, but it is as a mechanism. It is a mechanism that spreads the load across all payers and all categories, including self-insured ERISA exempt companies, and there are few mechanisms that can do that. And so it does provide a way to spread the load and protect the system that we have in place. It may take an increase.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for coming down today. And just to follow up a little bit on Representative Murphy's question, so if consultants were to come in, their job would be typically what, to focus on the things that are losing money? Is that kind of the essence of it? And how would those types of things be?
Yeah, the fear that always that you have about the tripping a bond covenant and then finding yourself with a consultant is that in some way you would be forced to make decisions that might be counter to your mission. And so as we've tried to apportion our priorities and our spending to do the best possible job for our community, at some point, something will pull up short. And so I'm not saying that in this particular situation the consultant would still be the board's responsibility, but it starts to shift. The responsibility starts to shift from the board, who has the responsibility to serve the community, to the bank that is really looking to protect the bondholders. And so at that point, you can expect priorities that the community felt were important would start to be the ones that would fall away. We have sites that lose money but provide key access to key populations and key communities that would be threatened in that situation.
We're going to have to move along because we're probably not going to get through all our testifiers. So thank you, Mr. Wessner. And what I want to do is jump ahead because I see in the schedule there's Mike Holmes from Cook, Minnesota, which is about 100 miles north of Duluth. And maybe we ought to get him on his way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Holmes. I'm the CEO of Scenic Rivers Health Services, which is based in Cook. We operate five clinic sites in northern Minnesota, primarily north of the Iron Range. These are in communities of Cook, Big Fork, Big Falls, Northholme, and Floodwood. I'm here today because I am strongly opposed to the cuts in Minnesota care that are presented in the governor's budget request. We've been a primary care access point for over 30 years. Last year, we served approximately 13,800 patients, primarily from Coochaching, St. Louis, Itasca, and Beltrami counties. The area around our clinic is about 7,500 square miles and has a permanent population of about 17,000 people. So we have more deer per square mile than people. Our current population density is about 2.2. Cook and Big Fork, all of our communities are small communities. Cook is the largest at 680 people. It's not uncommon for our patients to travel 60-plus miles just to access care at our facilities. And in some cases, we have patients coming over 100 miles to access specific services like low-income dental care. The healthcare marketplace is very limited for residents of northern Minnesota. Our service areas are both designated as medically underserved areas by the federal government. They contain health professional shortage areas, both in a medical and dental standpoint. And so it is because of this that we have issues with our patient populations in delivering care. Our Scenic Rivers physicians, we have eight physicians, four nurse practitioners, staff, two critical access hospitals in northeastern Minnesota. Those are the critical access hospitals in Cook and Big Fork. And we're serving a disproportionate share of low-income patients. Last year, 20% of our patients were enrolled in either Medicaid or Minnesota care. 31% of our patient population were uninsured. Another 18% had Medicare coverage, and there were only about 31% of our patient population that had commercial insurance. And those numbers are changing rapidly. Our Minnesota care population increased by 14% last year. Our uninsured population increased by 8%. And this is when the economy was still relatively healthy in early 2007. The effects of the job cuts and plant closures have yet to be felt within the northern part of the state. When Ainsworth announced the permanent closure of the board plants in Bemidji, Grand Rapids, and Cook, it had basically received just a one-sentence item in the back of the financial pages. But when Cook lost 140 jobs at the board plant just south of town, it has a huge effect on that population and on our service area. Beyond the mill workers, you have all of the support industry. The Cook plant consumed over 900,000 cords of wood a year when it was at full production. Between the three plants, they were producing requiring 3 to 4 million cords of wood. That's a lot of jobs for loggers and truckers, suppliers that aren't there anymore. And as a result, we know that we're going to see another huge increase in uninsured patients. Some of these patients will be new to us. Most of them will be patients that we've seen over a series of years. But this time they'll be uninsured rather than carrying commercial insurance. If the Minnesota care cuts are enacted, we will see a decrease of our Minnesota care population by about 10%, but we expect that population to get added to our uninsured population, and that 4,200 counts goes to 4,500. With the impact of the logging industry and the board plant closures and the other unemployment, that 4,500 count of uninsured patients will go to over 5,000. We had once hoped that the mines would pick up the slack. That is not going to happen. We expect there will be reductions in the mining industry as everybody awaits orders from steel. And certainly there's no safe haven with mining right at this point. The best case scenario from a patient care perspective is that those patients stay with us. The worst case for patient care is that they avoid seeking treatment and defer care and have those patient problems, chronic problems, compound to additional increases decreases in health status. Even under the best case, if those patients stay with us, and we expect they will, it's not a good case for us because we don't have the resources to provide for care for those increases in uninsured populations. Decreases in funding, whether we have a decrease in Minnesota care or a decrease in commercial insurance, will leave us with just a couple of alternatives. We can reduce some of the limited staff we have, or we can start rationing care to some of our uninsured patients. Either option is particularly palatable, but we don't have any choices. We have to find a way to spread fewer dollars over a wider number of uninsured patients. Cost shifting is not really an option for us. When you're down to 31% commercial insurance and that number decreasing, there isn't anybody left to cost shift to. Certainly we've heard about deteriorating margins in hospitals, declining margins in hospitals. Community health centers are lucky if they have a positive operating margin, and in many cases they have no positive operating margin. And so we have to look at how are we going to survive. And at this point, it's anybody's guess. Certainly, I'd like to thank the committee for taking time this morning or this afternoon, and would be willing to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Holmes?
My name is Deanna Mills, and Mike and I came as a duo, so I followed him down here.
Was there ice on the road?
No. A lot of rain. Mike runs a federally funded clinic like I do, and my name is Deanna Mills, and I run the Community University Healthcare Center in Minneapolis, located on Bloomington and Franklin Avenue in the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis. So many of the things that I would have testified, as Mike has already said, but let me give you just a little of urban picture rather than a rural picture of a similar situation. Much of us, many people in this room, started to grapple with this economic downturn last summer, but for many of our patients living in the inner city of Minneapolis, it happened at least a year before that when foreclosures started. And so many of our patients are in rental units, and so they basically, when their landlords foreclosed, they were looking at no place to live. So that was kind of the first strike for our patients. The second strike for our patients were, you know, when the economy starts to go like it has been, you know, some of the service jobs, the labor jobs, the odd jobs, they get cut out pretty quickly. So many of our patients then faced no jobs, or having to change jobs, so living, changing. And what my purpose here, hopefully, today is say, let's not let these really vulnerable people once again get the third strike, which would basically just leave them out of no health care. So it's an urban story, and COOK has been around for 42 years and have been serving low-income people for that long, and that is our core mission, and that's what we want to do. Now we're facing a that long, and that is our core mission, and that's what we want to do. Now we're facing a very new problem, and I know why it's happening after listening to the testimony from all of the hospitals today. They're a great system and have given all kinds of charity care, you know, over the history, and we appreciate that. But right now, the number of people that drive from the nine county metro area down to the corners of Franklin and Bloomington Avenue is astounding. We have a 35% growth rate at our clinic from people driving further than outside of Hennepin County down to the inner city of Minneapolis. So we have an ethical question for us after 42 years of serving very vulnerable patients. Should we even think about serving these people from the suburbs and the ex-suburbs? Because other systems that have traditionally served them, they're now looking for safety net providers to serve them. Who's going to choose? We don't like to do that. But this is how we're doing it today, by default. This is when I walk into the clinic every morning, we do not have enough dental service available, so we aren't open to adult patients. There are usually anywhere between 5 and 10 people who we say, come on in and sit, and when we get a no-show or something, we'll slip you in. Okay? So people are sitting there. They don't wait for dental hygienists. They wait for dentists because they're in pain. So I'm greeted by these people sitting there waiting with toothaches trying to get into our dental service. By 9 o'clock in the morning, we have about 100 chairs in our waiting room. They're full, okay? And there's more people who are waiting at the desk. The reason it's full is because we get approximately 2,000 calls to our scheduling, our mental health and our medical scheduling, which we can only answer 750 of them. We are eliminating access to our clinic simply because we can't answer our phone anymore. Now, this is like kind of back to the future. If you want to see what people are saying is going to happen, come visit us. You can see firsthand the travesties of this economic downturn. It hit first on the most vulnerable in our community, and it's then, of course, it's starting to hit, as all we know, to more of the middle class folks. It's bad, as we all know. Now, I want to appreciate Dr. Blewitt's comments, but she said something about in the rural areas, the hospitals are there as safety nets, but in the inner city, there certainly are clinics that they could go to. That is wrong. But the demand for services right now far exceeds our capacity. And we are already limiting access to our clinics. Because we simply don't have the capacity. So I am extremely fortunate to run a clinic that basically is part of the University of Minnesota. Some of the other clinics like Mike, they don't have kind of a larger system to help them through the crisis. Cook has been a community service of the University of Minnesota for 42 years, and certainly, my boss wants to continue those things, but, you know, the financial pressures on the University of Minnesota, even though it looks like an education, will certainly impact healthcare. So that is my testimony. I certainly would love to answer some questions if you have any, but you've got a rural and you've got an urban of the safety net that's extremely frayed. Thank you.
Representative Abors.
Thanks, and I'll be brief. It's just kind of striking testimony, frankly. I have to ask a pragmatic question, Mike or Mr. Holmes, Dr. Holmes. With your cost structure, you have some modest-sized clinics, I suppose, scattered around, and so probably most of your costs are staff?
76% of our costs are staff. They're labor or fringe-related. We have two clinics that are attached or adjacent to the critical access hospitals are where most of our physicians are. We have 4 physicians and 2 nurse practitioners in Big Fork. We have 3 physicians, and we supplement them with locum tenens physicians in Cook. We have nurse practitioner clinics in Floodwood and North Elm, and we rotate through a part-time clinic in Big Falls. But 3/4 of our costs are labor-related.
And so even as you cut back staff and your fixed costs go up with the percentage, and that kind of confounds your fiscal picture, I bet, right?
These are small clinics, small rural clinics. We don't achieve great economies of scale, although we have centralized MIS, management information systems. We are
currently implementing health information technology upgrades. We went live last year with an electronic health record for our physicians in our medical practice. Part of the problem that we're facing, and that we're, as we look downstream, we have to adapt to a changing healthcare delivery system in medical homes, and yet we have to survive the next 2 years to get to healthcare reform. And the challenge is, how do we do that? And that's the challenge.
And I know we're running off our schedule, but like the medical home part, which we all like, is that causing a burden to you to try to implement what's being asked of you so far?
We were fortunate in that we belong to a Northern Minnesota network with Sawtooth Mountain Clinic and the Migrant Health Service out of Moorhead. We received one of 12 national HIT grants. And so we're able to implement an electronic medical record and a shared information system funded by the Fed. And so that has not been a burden to us, but we were only one of 12 recipients.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Murphy, it's going to have to be quick, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Mills, I have a constituent who's a physician working at a community clinic in a different part of the metro area, and she's been reporting to me not only an increase in number of people being seen, but an increase in the acuity of the people coming to the community clinic. Is that something you're seeing? I mean, she's talking about complex fractures and things that you necessarily wouldn't expect to see in a community clinic now presenting there.
Cook is a little bit unique in its care model because we deliver health care in 7 different languages, and 70% of our patients, English is not their primary language. And so many times the patients come to our clinic when they should be going to an emergency room. I've been an executive director at another clinic, and we have probably the ambulance from HCMC come to our clinic at least 3 or 4 times a week, because patients come to our clinic because of a language capacity and because they know our providers. And we say, oh, my gosh, you should be at the emergency room. So, yeah, that happens frequently at our clinic. That is simply the emergency sort of activities happening. But the patients, as everybody has heard and testified today, they put off care, and then they come in sicker states than they ever came before.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks the two of you for your testimony. I just think it's remarkable, because I know Mr. Holmes' area a little bit, and rural really does not even describe it. And he's sitting next to somebody from downtown Minneapolis. It's pretty amazing. And they have the same problem.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Kevin Crossan from North Memorial.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my business, when you have another birthday, that's a good thing, so congratulations. I'll be quick. I'm going to be the one that doesn't throw a lot of numbers at you, just single-digit ones today. I am a general surgeon that's practicing in the community. I'm the president of a group of 9 surgeons in the Northwest Metro. I'm the director of the trauma program at North Memorial, which is a level 1 trauma center. And I'm on the board of trustees for the hospital. I also function as the chairman of the state trauma advisory committee. I'm not here in that capacity today. I'm here as a surgeon from North Memorial to briefly talk about actually something that's going right, but something that can go very wrong very easily. If we talk about the trauma system that's evolving and what it's doing to the systems here, you'll see the last few people on the list today to talk to you are from regions Hennepin and North Memorial. And the system for a long time has been based on the burden that those hospitals have carried in the metro. Our system has been built the right way. We're very new into it. We're about 3 years into it. We've got a verification process. We've required hospitals to upgrade their services they provide to you. Education is provided for out-state health providers that maybe see one trauma a year, and that's the worst one that you've ever imagined. It shows up in the emergency department on a holiday or during a night from an automobile accident or something worse, from a farm injury. We have a process where we're actually looking at performance and measuring it and valuing it and as far as how patient transfers go, how patient care goes. And we look at that, and we have a process to improve that, and we look at that through the use of state data. We talk about the fact that there are four levels, 1 through 4, and those are the numbers I'm going to share with you today so you can all rest easy. One is obviously a facility that provides definitive care for all patients. Two provides definitive care for most patients. And then it goes down. And four, sometimes simply a clinic with an interested physician that tries to provide emergency care in an area that doesn't have anything otherwise. So if you look at, if you walk through the process of how this works, this is a voluntary system in the state of Minnesota. So these hospitals have to volunteer their, or have to pay a tax, number one, to be a part of the system, but they also have to provide the services that are arguably, they don't see the immediate benefit from until they see that one or two patients that show up 4 or 5 times every decade for them. And so it's a big cost, and that's clearly going to go away when the money gets tighter. They're already kind of in tough shape, and this isn't going to help them at all. I think there's lots of examples of really good care that were provided here. If who can't remember the bridge collapse and the outstanding care that was provided by Hennepin County Medical Center and the other regional metro trauma hospitals. Outstanding rural trauma care is also delivered every day. If you take the pathway of a victim of a trauma accident, we can use Cook since they just spoke before me. If there's somebody that's injured up in Cook, Minnesota, in theory they're taken to a hospital that has a set of resources available that they'll bring them into that facility and be evaluated. We want patients in Minnesota to stay where they can get their care, and we want them to stay as close to home as at all possible. But if they need to be transferred, we want that decision to be made early on, and we want them to move through the process. We can only get that if we educate those physicians and those nurses that are providing that care, because they're not going to see it with the repetition it requires to be any good at it. So that burden has been carried by the level ones and twos through the state. They've gone out and done the education, and it's really been a cooperative venture through most of the hospitals in Minnesota, which I think is unusual in this environment. I mean, we've really been able to get everybody to work together and look at things and try to make it work appropriately. But clearly the burden's been carried by the ones and twos to provide that education. That's probably going to be tough to continue. All of us are feeling that effects. I don't know the exact numbers. I'm a board member, and so some of this is not perfectly accurate, but I know that North Memorial lost roughly $140 million last year, that they're not in jeopardy of their bond defaulting, but they're working on it. And I think the anticipated cuts, quite frankly, are what I was told and whispered to, and again, I'm not a numbers guy, but it was something like $23 million to the hospital's bottom line. Our budget for next year is a $900,000 operating margin. So that for 2009 is a $900,000 operating margin. And a lot of that is because of the uncompensated care and all the things you've heard about all day long, but it's also because of our support for the rest of the system in Minnesota. If you're a victim in Cook and you arrive at Cook and you get cared for by a physician that's been trained by one of the Metro Level 1 facilities and has been given the education appropriate to make the right decision, and you're fortunate enough to be then transferred in an appropriate period of time to a facility where they can care for you, whether that's Duluth, St. Cloud, or any one of the ones in the Metro, and you arrive there, there are people there waiting for you with special skills that are going to provide that kind of care that you need in order to survive. Those people can't be there if they're not paid. And the overhead for having people available at all times it's expensive. But what are we going to do without that? These times are horrible. And you guys know this as well as anybody, probably better than I do. But I'm the one that walks through the ER in the morning and sees the people jammed in there trying to get in to be seen because they can't afford to go to their clinics. And I think we all feel the impact of where we're going with here. But in times of a financial crisis, the one thing it seems to me we can't back off on is our provision of emergency care. That's going to be something we better maintain, or the seams are going to unravel on the whole system. I get it, the system's broken. I'm not smart enough to fix it for you. But we've got a little theme of good things to go through here that's happening, and people are starting to cooperate. So give us the platform to try to make it better here for the next few years, and let us do the best job we can and cooperate and support each other until we get through this process. These cuts are going to kill us. We won't be able to make it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Creston? Representative Rood, I knew it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I haven't had enough of these yet.
Happy birthday, and thank you, Mr. Crossman, right?
Dr.
Crossman, I apologize.
No problem.
You have one of the best heart surgeons at your hospital. It's my brother, Dr. Chris Heck. I have to put a plug there. But
he's a good heart surgeon. He's not a very good golfer.
I'll pass that on. Representative Murphy had a question earlier as we are grappling with trying to understand how these cuts, what they mean to the hospitals and the systems. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about, and maybe I shouldn't be asking this, but as we are trying to understand the extent of it, what this will mean for the new hospital that is being built.
I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that. I know it's still going forward. The rumor mill when you're in the middle of layoffs and things are going on is unbelievable. I was told on the way here today that we had a board meeting last week, and I was told by somebody that they heard that we had found another way to bonus the CEO and all of the vice presidents another $500,000, and we're going to lay another 100 people off. Obviously, that's not true. Obviously, that's not happening right now, and they're all frantically trying to fix whatever they can do to fix it. I can tell you that the new hospital is going to start up smaller than it was originally intended, and it's going to grow as it needs to. It's a beautiful facility. It'll be shelled in for all the space and all the beds that it was provided, but they're going to have to start smaller because nobody can absorb a hit that significant early on and keep running. We don't have the depth to be able to last through a big downturn. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. And next we have James Davis and Greg Bugherd from Centricare. Again, if you could compact it a little bit, it would help.
Good afternoon, almost evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jim Davis. I'm Vice President of Operations for Centricare Health System, and Greg Bugherd is here with me as the Vice President of Finance and CFO for the system. And I'm going to do exactly what you've asked. I have pages of scripted testimony that I'm not going to go through. Rather, what I'd like to do, because I could say ditto. And I think the testimony, the passionate testimony from Duluth, clearly a ditto. We can as a trauma center, I could say ditto again. So I just want to tell you some things that I think are a little bit unique about Centricare and the danger of having to do things to highly valued programs. Centricare is a three-hospital system. Two of them are critical access, Melrose and Long Prairie, and the largest tertiary facility is St. Cloud, the St. Cloud Hospital. St. Cloud Hospital has been named the top 100 six times. Our heart hospital has been named the top 100 eight times. We're a magnet hospital for nursing. We're in the U.S. News. And the only reason I raise that is because I like to brag, but also the way you get those awards is to deliver the highest quality care at the lowest cost, therefore creating the highest value for your community. Well, at St. Cloud Hospital on an average day, and I don't know when that is, we have probably about 320 patients in the hospital. On that same day, we have over 300 patients in our behavioral and substance abuse program. So I want to get you into sort of the scale of what's at danger here for those very poorly and poorly reimbursed programs. We have 11% of our patients on Medicaid, 48% of them on Medicare, so we are a disproportionate share hospital, and therefore will be disproportionately damaged by these cuts that are being proposed by the governor. My role at Centricare, I have responsibility for several of what I will call our critical mission programs, and I just want to tell you about a couple of them because they're the ones that are so poorly reimbursed that we have to subsidize to a significant extent that I believe are in most danger if we have to cut back to just doing our core business. The first one is the Mid-Minnesota Clinic. The Mid-Minnesota Clinic was one of the first things I did when I came to St. Cloud 20 years ago, and it was to bring together kind of a coalition of folks in St. Cloud and figure out how could we deliver care and create access for patients who were either uninsured or underinsured. And we have been in business now for 20 years providing that care. It's interesting, I think, that as I'm flipping through trying to only take the big numbers here, that the St. Cloud population has a small percentage of black and other minorities, but the population of patients in the Minnesota clinic in those minorities exceeds 35%. It is the clinic of entry for the immigrants. We spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on translation services to be able to communicate effectively with these patients. I hate to tell you, but that's one of the programs that is in danger with these kinds of cuts. So I'm going to move on from there quickly and talk about behavioral medicine. I mentioned the vast number of patients that we're seeing on a daily basis, but I want to tell you about the innovative programs that we're trying to implement and deliver to reduce the cost of providing those much-needed services. Let me tell you about Clara's House. Clara's House is a program of partial hospitalization for children and teens who need care for behavioral or substance problems. Those were extraordinarily difficult to deliver in any kind of economy as an inpatient. And most of them don't really require the nursing services of the inpatient. And so Clara's House is a partial hospitalization program where intensive outpatient care is delivered on a daily basis to these patients, and they can then go home at night to their families. Families are integrated into that care. We were only able to really do that and are able to continue it because through philanthropy, the facility was built entirely with donated money. So the philanthropic gifts have allowed us to create that facility and maintain that service, but it provides a much-needed service to teens and children that would find it very difficult otherwise. A scattergram that was presented to us at one point by our planning department shows that the patients we serve at the Mid-Minnesota Clinic and through our behavioral services come well beyond a 30-mile radius of St. Cloud and, in fact, are clustered significantly out of the Twin Cities as we serve patients who can't get into those services either here or outstate. Let me tell you a little bit about our Recovery Plus program. That's the one that has well over 300 patients a day. Recovery Plus is a part of our overall care for folks with substance issues. But Recovery Plus is a special program created so that mothers can go into treatment and take their children with them. So instead of sending the children off to foster care and breaking up families, mothers who have significant issues with substance come into Recovery Plus. And the greatest challenge we had was, I think it took us 2.5 years for the state to figure out how to license it so that we could get daycare licensure as well as care licensure for these patients. They live together, the families are sustained, the moms receive care, and we believe it's an important model, one that but delivers care that's needed and reduces the cost of foster care and other social issues. So we're, you know, really proud of that. We're also delivering integrated behavioral care through our clinics, and that is where we place psychologists in our primary care clinics to identify early children at risk and begin treatment early on an outpatient basis before they need Clara's House or other more intensive care. And we're doing that through a Diamond Project in Melrose and another integrated behavioral program through our CentraCare pediatric clinic in St. Cloud. We believe that reduces the cost, it intervenes early, and has much better outcomes. But those are underfunded programs that if we have to get back to the core, I think are at great risk. So we do subsidize these programs. We're at capacity. Our psychiatrists can take no more new patients. It's interesting that if we hire a psychiatrist today, we know we'll have to subsidize behavior another $700,000. patients that they attract, the care that they deliver, $700,000 to subsidize that psychiatric care. I think those are important numbers. Again, I'm concerned that you understand the potential impact. And the other thing I would say about St. Cloud Hospital that I think is a little bit unique, in that there is not another facility like it within 65 miles. So a trauma patient, a critically injured patient, critically ill patient, may not actually be able to sustain the trip on into the Twin Cities. And so our being present and being available to care for and to create access for those patients, I think is a public safety issue in its own. And I came prepared to tell you stories about patients that are dramatic in terms of the impact, but you don't have time. And we don't have time, and I'd love to share them with you at another time. And with that, I'm open to questions.
Questions for Mr. Davis? And I would like to share some of those, or have you share some of those individual stories, because they're very important in how we get people to think about problems.
So for every psychiatrist you hire, you're because of the reimbursement rates and the other affiliated costs, you lose $700,000. That's the easy way.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
In our integrated delivery of behavioral medicine, and you're the expert here, but when you take in all the costs of inpatients, outpatients, the clinic costs and everything, for every psychiatrist we employ, and our psychiatrists are all employed by the system, we lose $700,000. So this year we're on course to lose almost $8 million in our behavioral area.
Could you get those numbers to us?
Sure. I think you have them somewhere, but I'll get them to you. Yeah, our Mid-Minnesota clinic, you know, a small family practice clinic, but it requires a $2 million annual subsidy to care for those patients.
The story about the shortage of psychiatrists and mental health workers is statewide.
Could you identify yourself?
I'm Greg Kluger, Chief Financial Officer at Central Care. I only have one brief add to that behavioral health issue. It's a statewide phenomenon. Recently in our local paper, the impact in our community and the surrounding community was identified. And if you have had personal experience close to you, when someone suffering from mental illness can't find service, I'm sure you're moved by the impact of the shortage of behavioral health services in your community, and it can only be exacerbated by what's in store for the healthcare industry.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one brief question for Mr. David. And if you have to cut staffing, the nursing staffing in particular, will that jeopardize your magnet status at the hospital?
Good question, Mr. Chair and members. I think that we are staffed very carefully, and the magnet status is extremely important in attracting and retaining nurses. And I think as we look at how we would cut, it would probably be, again, in program areas that are not directly related to nursing hours per patient. I think that would be the last place we would look to cut.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony, and I'm going to, again, change the order here. The last three, Mark McAfee, Evelyn Stringer, and Judy Minter, they could come down. They're all from Ask Me, and Mark, you're here 80 hours a week, so you can be brief.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee, representing Ask Me Council 5. The only thing I'll say is I hope you have many more birthdays and live long enough to see your dream of health care reform and universal coverage for all become a reality. with me today, I have, we represent folks at Fairview University and HCMC and also Regents Hospital. With me, I have two people today that can give you a ground's eye view of what's going on with some of these issues, and they'll be brief. So.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Evelyn Stringer, and I do represent Local 72 Acme and Regents Hospital. And I thank you for giving us the opportunity to share our concerns today. What I do at Regents Hospital, I am a patient account representative. I assist patients with making payment plans and other arrangements as seeking other financial means of payment. Our facility promises to provide our patients with the best care and the best experience possible. We have translators, we have billing invoices that are translated so we could assist our patients with filing for health care and financial assistance when they don't have any insurance. We do everything possible that we can do. We serve our community with respect and care. We have patients that come to the ER for medical attention because they can be turned away at clinics. And what I mean by that, you have to make copays. And if you don't have a copay when you go to the clinic, you won't be seen. But if you go to the emergency room, they cannot turn you down. And what happens is, because of our economic times, it's hit us all hard. And even though our patients do their best to pay their bills, we have seen a rise in having to submit accounts to collections and the revenue recapture program. We know firsthand the struggles that our patients are going through. We talk to them every day. Due to the high cost of medical care, many people choose not to do their follow-up work and get the necessary treatment that is needed. In some instances, we have to call outside agencies to report that these patients call us, and they're talking about, you know, they're threatened. They talk about harming themselves because they don't know what to do. If our hospitals don't have the necessary funding to serve our community and our patients, we will all suffer. Hospitals will not be able to afford the staff needed to cover the increase of patients seen in the ER and already admitted. This causes concern for patient care. I urge you members, Mr. Chair and members, to lend your heart to our message today. We need your support in providing the necessary services to our community.
Thank you. You go to the next one, please.
Good afternoon, Sir Chair and members of the committee. My name is Judy Minter, and I'm a service worker at Regents Hospital, and I've been there for 7 years in the housekeeping department. In my service position at Regents, I've heard and seen how our patients are affected in these hard times. I support various departments in the hospital and where I work. Within the past year, I have seen our emergency room become more crowded and have become increased with patients, and the waits have become very long for patients waiting to be seen because of no insurance and the lengthy paperwork to be filled out to try to get them the help that they need. While I'm working close by our patients, I hear things like, what are we going to do? Where do we go? We need medical attention now. We cannot wait. It is no surprise to any of us here today that we're concerned and frightened with the bad economy, and we cannot afford no more cuts from our budget, but most of all from our health care system. I urge you members, Sir Chair, to please hear our plea in this urgent matter and not make any further cuts in the health care funding of our hospitals. This country is suffering from a disease right now, and it's called the economic system, but it's curable. We can stop this now by not cutting further into the budget and to our hospitals and patient care. Thank you for your listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? I don't see any, so thank you very much, and thank you for your long wait.
Thank you, and happy birthday.
And next we have Mary Braddock from Children's Hospital, and then we have, after them, Lynn Abramson and Michael Belzer from Hennepin County Medical Center. And if you could, we're way over time now, but if we can get out, if we can, you can do yours in 5 minutes, and they can do theirs in 5 minutes.
I will. Thank you. Happy birthday, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mary Braddock, and I'm a pediatrician at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, and also the Director of Child Health Advocacy and Policy. The economic downturn has been difficult for children's, as it has been for many people, and you've heard that all afternoon. During calendar year 2008, as the stock market plummeted, children's experienced investment losses totaling $60 million. As with any organization, these losses have impacted children in many ways. We have relied on investment returns of 5% annually to fund any capital replacement or investment, and so the dramatic stock market losses have limited our ability to replace aging and outdated equipment as scheduled. In addition to investment losses, we have also seen strong evidence of financial struggle among our patients and their families. In 2008, children experienced a 31% increase in bad debt from approximately $8.9 million to nearly $12 million. And this increase is primarily due to families being unable to meet their copay and deductibles. We are also seeing an increase in families who describe themselves as self-pay, or often no pay. And perhaps related to this, we've had nearly a 7.5% increase in the emergency department visits since 2006. Our two emergency departments now see more than 82,000 visits annually. Thirdly, we're seeing a steady increase in the number of our patients on Medicaid and prepaid medical assistance. In 2008, our Medicaid and PMAP payer mix increased to 39.2% from 37.4% in 2007 and up from 30% in 2003. As you can imagine, this increase is due to a variety of factors: higher unemployment, the increasing inability of small employers to offer health insurance to their employees or to include family coverage in their benefit package, and finally, an inability of many employees to afford the health insurance that their companies do offer. And this is especially true, as you can imagine, with families with young children. But the story would not be complete without discussing the disproportionate burden of recent public program cuts on children. Since 2003, Children's has sustained $58 million in budget cuts through a series of ongoing ratable reductions in Medicaid reimbursement, multiple Medicaid rate rebasing delays, an increasing volume or increasing number of patients insured by Medicaid, and an increased Medicaid and PMAP payer mix. So that's $58 million over the last 5 years. We estimate that the governor's recent unallotment of quarterly supplemental payments and proposed budget cuts to Medicaid for the next biennium will have an impact on Children's of $8.9 million in 2009 and $16 million in 2010. Moreover, the gap between the cost of care and public program reimbursement continues to widen. Between 2007 and 2008, Children's cost in excess of Medicaid and other government programs would have increased by nearly 29% without quarterly supplemental payments. Yet, these quarterly supplemental payments have also been proposed to be eliminated. These enormous losses to a single organization are due to the fact that Children's is the largest provider of care to children on Medicaid in the state. So any cuts to Medicaid disproportionately impact our hospital and jeopardize our ability to continue providing state-of-the-art care to Minnesota children deserve. We are a tertiary or even a quaternary care children's hospital, meaning nearly half of our beds are intensive care, so that the children we serve disproportionately require the most complex care available, which makes us even more sensitive to delays in Medicaid rate rebasing. Children's has responded to the slowing economy, stock market decline, and cumulative legislative budget cuts by making many hard decisions. These decisions have impacted our staff as well as our patients and their families.
Children's has eliminated 125 positions since June. This has been accomplished through layoffs, early retirements, and elimination or freezing of open positions. We have reduced the number of clinical educators, psychologists, social workers, and restricted vouchers that assist families of hospitalized children in paying for parking, meals, and transportation. We have reduced capital expenditures for new or replacement equipment by half and reduced nearly all discretionary spending. We have also been forced to eliminate programs. We have eliminated our two school-based clinics in Minneapolis, closed our exercise medicine program in St. Paul, including its Native American outreach program, and pulled our physical and occupational therapy support for Reuben Lynn Family Services therapeutic daycare program. We have delayed the implementation of aspects of our electronic health record, including computerized provider order entry, and deferred many key aspects of our campus development project. Children's remains committed to providing the tens of thousands of children we serve next generation care. We are also committed to operating as efficiently as possible and eliminating waste in our system. But as the economy continues to stagnate, we ask that the Medicaid program, which supports nearly 40% of the care we provide, remain strong. The children whose lives we hold really depends on it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Braddock. Questions? Seeing none? Well, I think we're running out of questions, too. So we have two more people, Lynn Abramson, the administrator of Hennepin County Medical Center, and Dr. Michael Belzer. And if I have a little story to tell about Dr. Belzer when he gets done, if he doesn't tell it about himself.
Right. Good afternoon, and thanks for having us. The hour is late, so I'll try to just get to some salient points. It's been a little bit rewarding to be up standing or sitting and listening and hearing our names so often. So I believe you already know a few of the things that I might have said.
You might, members might be interested to know, probably 70% of the doctors in the state of Minnesota have got part of their training at Hennepin County Medical Center.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. I was going to mention that as well. Great. Just a few quick things. Dr. Blewett already mentioned that we're the biggest provider of uncompensated care. Unfortunately, our volume was up 9% in 2008, and we continue to see major volume increases. Of course, much of that is uncompensated care. That's a sign of the times and what we expect in the future. We also, though, took the biggest hit of the hospitals in unallotment with an $11.9 million cut. We've just really gotten through that. You probably saw the headlines. I think we announced those cuts just before the governor's budget came out. Just in time. Now we'll have to do some contingency planning around that particular budget. But that was $12 million on top of the $7, $8 million that we took as of last July. That's a lot of money for an operation that does not live with much of a margin. I kind of share that with the community clinic. Thank you, Deanna. So we don't aspire to much of that, but we do need to recapitalize, and that's for the good of the citizens that we serve. Along with the Hennepin County losses on local government aid, we are no longer counting on the county as such a backstop. I think people have gotten complacent about thinking that HCMC will always be there, but this level of cuts, now we're really going to get into the serious thinking about restricting access and closures. And no, I don't have specifics because I'm not going to be irresponsible about that. We've just done the first cut. We will now have to be thinking about looking at our criteria, trying to figure out what's the least harm. We will do it responsibly, and it's not a threat, but there will be access and closures. That'll just be our reality. My last comment would be that we do have some ideas about how to work with you all to try to figure out a way to get some federal match that we might not have thought of, so we stand ready to do that, but now is not the time to do that. I think the one part that I would hope people can wait for is that Dr. Belzer, our medical director, has a slant on this that I don't think has been brought up yet this afternoon. So with that, I will introduce Dr. Belzer.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Michael Belzer, and I'm the chief medical officer and medical director of Hennepin County Medical Center, and I've held that position for the last 20 years. You've heard most of the hospital representatives so far talk about the serious nature of the governor's proposed cuts to the various urban and rural hospitals and the very real threats to their rural program and mission. And you've heard additional comments about cost shifting and that patients are going to get sick anyway. And let me just take a little different tack and a little different view of the issue. And rather than talking about hospitals or hospital finances or hospital-related jobs or the increased number of emergency department visits, let me look at take a look at the consequence to the health of the individual that loses their insurance. So imagine for a moment that you as a committee member are one of the 100,000 estimated Minnesotans that will lose their health insurance. First, you're not alone. You'll be joining 400,000 others in the state of Minnesota who are presently uninsured. But unfortunately for you, the mere loss of your insurance will not be just simply inconvenience having to wait in a public hospital like Hennepin County Medical Center or go to an inconvenient health care facility or go to a community clinic waiting room or have delays in your care because your private doctor won't see you. Let's be clear that the lack of health insurance is a real disease and, as it turns out, is a fatal disease. And I'll present some data to back that up. Much has been written about the demographics of the uninsured, the reasons for their uninsurance, the cost of providing coverage, but very little has been published about the health consequences. The prestigious Institute of Medicine that hopefully most of you have heard of, in their landmark 2002 study, estimated, and this is a very credible group that is national in scope, and their report estimated that 18,000 U.S. residents will die each year because they lack insurance. Recent updates from that data suggest that the Institute of Medicine actually underestimated the annual death due to lack of health insurance. Two longitudinal studies report that the uninsured have a 25% higher risk of death, are 3.2 times more likely to die in the hospital than the insured. The excess death rate due to uninsurance doesn't respect gender, age, or disease state. For example, uninsured women with breast cancer have a 50% higher adjusted risk of death compared to insured women. Uninsured pregnant women have a 33% higher chance of an adverse hospital outcome, including infant death after giving birth. Uninsured diabetics are 11 times more likely to experience avoidable hospitalization. A 2004 study from the Harvard Medical School faculty just looked at the near elderly, a group that's near and dear to my heart since I'm one of those. That's the 50 to 64-year-olds. Once you become 65, of course, you have Medicare and you're insured. But in that near elderly group, there's a risk-adjusted 43% higher death rate than insured, and a 53% increase in premature deaths in that age group. And not surprisingly, it's the patients with high blood pressure, diabetes, or heart disease that were the most affected. The back to the near elderly, as you can imagine, with the increasing aging of the baby boomers, it's estimated that increased death rate in that group alone, due solely to uninsurance, will be up to 30,000 patients per year in the United States. And all this leads us to believe that if the mere lack of insurance, and let's just call it uninsurance, were categorized as a disease, so let's call uninsurance a disease, it would be the third leading killer of near adults in the United States, right behind heart disease and cancer. So, no doubt, health insurance saves lives. The companion statement, which is lack of health insurance loses lives, leads us all to ask, whose interests are best served by putting 20% more or 100,000 Minnesotans without insurance? And I think it's time to realize, and I know that you do, that the concept of uninsurance leads to a fatal disease, and sustaining this newly defined entity that we've just done today and calling it uninsurance in the name of fiscal responsibility or tax avoidance or balanced budget is probably unconscionable and poor public policy. So that completes my comments.
Questions for either one? Well, my story is I was watching you on a panel. You were up on the stage, and it was about healthcare economics and competition in the healthcare system. And you said that Hennepin County was very good at this competition in the healthcare marketplace, but you had cornered the market on the uninsured.
Yes. Yep.
So, if there's no questions, we'll adjourn the meeting, and I want to thank everybody that waited till the end. I think you've all done a great job, and you've really made some very strong points that we're going to have to pay attention to in the next month. Thank you very much.